What's happening, guys? Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Let There Be Talk. Today, Monday, September 29th. How is everybody? Y'all out there rocking? Y'all out there rocking? I don't even know why I had that weird southern draw. Y'all out there rocking? It's probably because my guest today has been living out in Nashville. Steve Gorman. Steve Gorman, the drummer for the Black Crowes, arguably one of the greatest drummers in the last 25 years, and of course, one of my favorite bands, top 10 bands, Black Crowes. Seen him a gazillion times, love every record, not every record, but love what they do, man. I've been a fan since day one. And it was just incredible to have Steve on. I mean, to say I'm a fan is, I mean, putting it light. I've seen him, like, you know, I told Steve probably over 75 times. So Black Crowes, I've seen the most out of anybody, except for maybe the Mother Hips. So, yeah, man, what an honor to have Steve on. He's in town. He came over to the house yesterday. He's here to do a gig with his new band, Trigger Hippie. They're playing this Wednesday at the El Rey. I'm going to that. It's got Joan Osborne singing and Jackie Green. If you're a Black Crowes fan, of course, you know who Jackie Green is. This episode is fantastic. Steve came over. We were rocking little Doors on the turntable. Then we sat on the couches and talked a couple hours about the history of Black Crowes and Steve. What a fucking dream for me. I was just like, wow, this is so cool. That's coming up. I just want to talk about a couple things before we do get into the episode. Over the weekend, I went over to Amoeba, picked up some vinyl, and just steaming. I can't believe what's going on, and it's just time to talk about it. But, you know, here's what I got. I got the Caius reissues, they just came out, Caius Records on vinyl. And then I got Queens of the Stone Age Rated R on vinyl. I bring them home, I open them up, put them on the turntable, ready for some just sonic desert rock. And instead I just get like subpar, maybe cassette sound coming off these $35 records that were just garbage. Absolute garbage. Now, this is not the first time this happened to me, and I'm just so stupid. I get in Amoeba and I get excited. You see the cover, you know, your favorite record that you've never owned on vinyl because they were out during the non-vinyl era. And you see that big old cover, and you go, oh, I gotta get this. And you buy it, then you run home. I should have Googled first. And I'm gonna have to do it from now on. You're gonna have to Google whose record you bought or you're going to buy. Right on the record for a store, or do it before you go there and get a list, you know, like Google Caius vinyl reissues and review. And then it'll pop up right away. You'll see just chat boards of dudes just going, this is fucking garbage. You know, it's a cash grab from some label. This is what happens. I'll tell you exactly what happens. The greedy record company, you know, They know vinyl's hot. It's been, you know, 100 years since Caius put a record out. They just fucking press them up on vinyl. They master them off the fucking CD or just whatever shit, you know, digital file they have, and they make a record. That's not a record. It's not why you buy vinyl. Yeah, I know it's hip now to buy vinyl because it's cool and fun, but the point is, for the oldest thing in the book. Vinyl sounds better. And when it sounds worse than a cassette or a digital MP3, fucking something's wrong. And those people at the label know it. They put it on, they go, this sounds like garbage. Put it out. No one will care. And records are the only thing in the history of being a consumer that is almost impossible to return. When you come back, they just look at you like, you know, like, oh, no returns. And it's like, no, fuck you. Somehow that magical, like, law, that fake law rule of like, yeah, you can't return records. That's just been like forever. But I was pissed. I was like, nah. Look, it's not like I didn't like the music, you know. I can understand you don't return a record because you don't, you know, you don't return something because you didn't like the record. I mean, I bought records when I was young and had one song and I was just chapped. Like, oh, the rest of the record sucks. I get that. That's not what it's about. It's about shitty product. It's like if you go down and buy a new car and the fucking paint starts falling off the next day, you're not just going to keep driving it. You're going to go back. So I go back and I got to give hats off to me, but they did give me my money back. I don't know if they want anybody to know that, but he tried to balk for a minute and I was like, nah, dude, I'll fucking light you up on Twitter. I'm a Twitter bully. I mean, I probably wouldn't have done that. Oh, yeah, I would have. I was just mad. It's not, and you know, maybe it's not Amoeba's fault, someone said, but, you know, they label their used records like slight scratches, a little bit of wear, you know, mint condition. Label these things terrible sounding, you know, only cool for the cover. This sounds like garbage. Don't buy, you know, whatever. Just put some labels on those things. Not remastered from the original analog tapes. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, even Cedric was talking about it. When you're making vinyl, there's two different master tapes. One is for, you know, iTunes these days, but, you know, back in the day, CDs. And one is for record. So you EQ those different. You're not going to use a CD master to press vinyl. Just fucking ripping people off. And I'm mad. I'm mad because also I think the label or the bands, if you know it, I don't know. If you know they're putting this stuff out and it sounds like shit, give it a shout out. The first time this happened to me was Metallica. I brought those, bought the Warner Brothers reissues. They came out, I think, in 2008. And these were the worst piece of shit on the planet. I wouldn't even eat off them. You know, the only thing they were good for is maybe Frisbee up at Beechwood Canyon. Just old school playing some Frisbee with vinyl. Okay, so I vented. There it is. But it's real. You can't charge. Look, if you charge $8 for it and it sounds like shit, yeah, you charge $8. Sounds like shit. But $35 for the Queens of the Stone Age rated X version. It was the red cover rated X one. $35. You know? And it was like not worth $5. So my point is, if you're going to buy records, try to buy the originals. And then if the band doesn't have, you know, originals out, like they're a newer band, Google and see if it sounds any good, you know? And then don't buy garbage. A lot of people don't even know. They just buy and go, hey, I'm collecting vinyl now. I'm listening to vinyl. It's cool. And they don't even notice. I put this thing on, the Caius one. My stereo never goes past like 4. I had to put it up on like 6, and then it was like, I knew I was in trouble, and then just pop, just terrible mud came out of my gorgeous 70s vintage speakers. What kind of audio dick do I sound? My $300 speakers, imagine like I'm some audiophile. My gorgeous vintage speakers made of wood. Anyway, fuck you if you're doing the cash grab, record companies. Come on, man. That's uncool. enough of that. This week, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, I'll be with Jay Moore at Irvine Improv. I hope to see all of you. It's going to be so much fun. I love working with Jay, man. It's just going to be an awesome weekend. The episode, I've got a new sponsor, and I want to get into this here. This guy's fantastic. His name's Corey Wallace, and he emailed me a sticker idea about a month ago, which you might have seen if you follow me on Twitter or Instagram. It's the mustache, the mustache sticker. So he said, hey, I made some stickers I want to send to you. I can't donate to the podcast, but maybe this will help. And I absolutely loved them. I couldn't believe how fucking great it was. And then I tweeted it, and it just lit fire. People were just unbelievable how much they loved it. So I called the guy, started talking to him, and man, I'm just using this guy for my art now. Him and Kevin Christie, between the two, they just have this, artistic eye that just blows me away. Anyway, Corey's company is separate from Kevin. I don't want to confuse you guys. Like, oh, what? Kevin works on... No, no. Kevin's a comedian. You guys know who he is. But he did a couple great things for me, like the Let There Be Talk logo. Anyway, Corey is doing my stickers now. You looking for any kind of cool artwork of your comedian or band or company that listens to this, like Earthquaker Devices? Maybe you want some cool stickers. There's a cross promo there for you. It's called Catatonic, and it's catatonic.com. It's CADATONIC.com or on Instagram at Catatonic. Check them out. Here's the deal, man. They got a contest going right now for anybody that listens to Let There Be Talk. They're doing a contest. You can submit a drawing, and these guys can do like 3D toys from your drawing. Even if it's just like a shitty drawing on a napkin or whatever, they've got all kinds of badass shit going on there. Go to their website. Check them out. They're a small, tight-knit group. You get your own artist. You can work directly with the artist. I did. I was calling them on the phone, emailing back and forth. They're influenced by some of my favorite artists like Robert Williams, Mark Ryden, Chris Cooper, that kind of stuff. These guys, man, what a great sponsor. Basically, I've got cool new stickers and a cool friend. So check them out. Thanks, guys, for the stickers. Super cool. I think that's about it because I'm just my head's falling off lately. Did I tell everyone I don't have to move? I'm not sure if I did, but I came home on last Tuesday, to some great news. I do not have to move. Landlady has saved the day. So, oh, God. So that, and thanks for all your cool emails, everybody. Like, that was great support. You guys are so nice. Keep following me on Instagram and Twitter. Del Razors, light the candles of rock. And I'll have stickers and shirts and stuff coming soon in the next week or so. And also, if you want to donate to the podcast, DeanDelRay@yahoo.com. Anything helps. I'm still going to have to get a new computer one day. This thing's been chugging along. But man, does it take abuse. Here he is right here. Steve Gorman, you are a rock king, dude. Thank you. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Keep spreading the word. Word of mouth, grassroots, rock and roll, tape trading. Let There Be Talk. All right, here we are. Another episode of Let There Be Talk. I got an incredible guest today, Steve Gorman. How are you, buddy?
I am enjoying the Delray Museum.
Yeah.
This is awesome.
Man, that's cool. It's awesome that you're here, man.
You drive into the Hollywood Hills. My man's rocking the Morrison Hotel. I walk in, and I'm seeing... I don't even know how to describe it. It's just life how it should be.
It's the Rock Library, right?
It's the Rock Library. Very impressive, my man.
It's funny because a lot of the stuff is Black Crowes here, and huge Black Crowes fan. We actually met before, and it's a funny story. I flew out solo to see Black Crowes at the New Orleans Voodoo Fest. And it turns out to be your last show.
Oh, in 2001.
Yeah. So Doug was the tech for
Doug
Rich.
Doug Redler, yeah.
That's right. And he goes, hey, you want to meet Steve? The other guys are kind of in a bad mood. And I go on, and you're watching that, football or something.
That would have applied at any time. But yeah. Blanket statement from the crew usually.
Right, right. And I go on, and it's just me, you, and Doug, and I don't know you at all. And you're talking sports. I'm like, oh, I want to talk rock. You know what I mean? I'm like, and I just was like, wow, that was weird. He liked sports a lot.
At that time, the last thing I probably was thinking about was rock. If there was ever a time when it was not on my brain, it was the fall of 01. So,
yeah, what happened there, man? That was just the end.
It was
right?
just unraveled.
Yeah.
You know?
As
it goes.
Yeah, of course.
And just ready to be done once and for all.
I've seen the Black Crowes probably, I don't know, maybe 75 times.
No shit.
Yeah. All over, all great shows. One time with Dylan at Laguna Seca.
Now, that was a badass show.
Fuck yeah, right?
And P-Funk was on that.
Yeah, remember that?
And George Clinton was wearing a Lion's King bedsheet as a toga. Dude, the best part of that day... was we're backstage and the band and Parliament Funkadelic, they're on stage, right? They start their set and there's no George. And no one knows where he is, but they got to go. They're 10 minutes into the opening jam, and that backstage, you see the station wagon taxi coming down the hill.
Whoa!
And it pulls up to the backstage. The security lets it through. It pulls right to the backstage, and George Clinton gets out.
That's amazing.
It was like an old Vista Cruiser station wagon, like 70s old beat up station wagon.
That's
taxi
so
cab. And he's wearing a Lion King bedsheet, like a toga.
Lion King.
And I was like, damn, there's George. It was great.
That was the time where they were kind of a huge comeback because Snoop Dogg had sampled a lot of stuff, and then Snoop brought him out on tour, and then all of a sudden George Clinton was everywhere for a while. And I was seeing him a lot. He'd play like 4 fucking hours.
I'm watching the start of the set, and they're getting it, and then I go back into our tent to, you know, get a beer or whatever after a while. And at one point, you hear the band sort of fall away, and there's a drum solo. And I'm like, oh, I should go check that out. And then our backstage area, we had a tent. The door, the flap opens up, and it's the drummer, the guy who was on the kit.
Yeah.
And he goes, man, can I grab one of those red stripes? And I looked at him. I said, who's on the kit? He goes, I don't know, one of them.
Oh.
And I walked up, and like, so it was the guy who had started the gig on bass.
Yeah, that's great.
Was taking the drum solo because this guy needed to go get a beer. And I was like, that's a good band to be in.
That's a great band, right? Like, hey, I got to go take a piss. Yeah, just jam on this.
But that's one everybody remembers. That George Clinton and Bob Dylan and us, man. That was a
magic day. I remember I had a 68 Cadillac. My friend was working backstage. Uh-huh. I just pooled backstage in this maroon Cadillac like a rock star.
Yeah, right.
I'm not even on the bill.
Nice.
I parked 2 feet from the metal stage and walked
up
and just sat on stage all night.
Yeah.
I remember specifically Dylan was standing next to me, and it was the first time I met him. And I looked over and go, oh, fuck, that's Dylan. So I said, man, it's going to be cold later. Mm-hmm. And he's all, never thought of that. And then later they had these big heaters on stage, you know?
Yeah.
And I later talked to Jacob, and he goes, that's probably the best thing you could have said to him. Instead of like, oh, your music
anything
changed
but
my
that.
Life.
Yeah,
right.
Anything but that.
That was a great day, man. Amorica record. You had Bobo. It was kind of like the first time I was seeing that lineup, you know? And it fantastic.
Well, you know, Bobo wasn't doing gigs with us. He did the record, but we had a different dude on tour.
Oh, who was the guy?
A guy named Chris Trujillo.
Oh, I thought it was Bobo.
No,
he
was on in the studio with us, but he didn't tour with us.
That guy was great. He was
good. Yeah, he's awesome.
Let's go to the beginning. Actually, when you joined Black Crowes, the first record. So you joined right on the demos.
Yeah, I moved to Atlanta in '87. And
where are you from?
From Kentucky. It was a town called Hopkinsville. And I'd been in college for 3.5 years and was in school just playing a lot of pickup basketball and wishing I was in a band. That's all I did for 3 years. An efficient waste of a perfectly good Pell Grant is how I look back on that. You know what I mean? Like,
you were like playing drums in what, cover bands or something?
Well, I wasn't. I mean, I wasn't even playing yet. I just always wanted to. And I the first time I sat at a drum kit was like my senior year of high school, and I immediately just could start. I mean, I've been spending my whole life wanting to play drums, and it just didn't happen. You know, and the first time I sat behind a kit, like, I knew exactly what to do. Like, I started playing.
Yeah.
And I had about 30 good seconds in me, and then I was like, fuck, that's harder than I thought it was going to be, you know.
Now, how come you weren't playing in high school at all?
Because I was in a small town and I went to a really small school.
Yeah.
Nobody else in my, I didn't know of a single other guy that played any instrument. Like, that we didn't have a marching band.
Yeah.
We didn't have a football team. You know, I played, and I was a jock. I have five older brothers, and we were all just.
Yeah, because you're a big dude. How tall are you?
6'3".
Hey, fucking.
And I'm the runt of the family.
That's
too,
crazy.
So my, you know, I mean, to me, like, and plus, I moved to Kentucky from Baltimore when I was 10, and I moved to a place, and it's just basketball all the time.
Yeah, like Hoosiers.
And it, very much so. And so, you know, up until like eighth grade, like, I was obsessed with the Beatles and Earth, Wind, and Fire, and all, you know, all the bands I was really into were just giant bands.
Right.
And then the first time I saw, you know, something about, like, I mean, when I started seeing, like, punk, I was a little too young for still to see it. Plus, I was in a place where it wasn't available. But
right.
New Wave, like Blondie, you know, and then Devo was the first. Like, I saw Devo on Saturday Night Live and went, I don't know what that is, but I'm there.
That's funny
and
you said that.
And the B-52s. And that's the first shit that really grabbed me that wasn't a you know.
Yeah,
wasn't,
like Rock Lobster.
That, yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
Saturday Night Live had these great performances,
and then,
you know.
And Devo was on Fridays, that old
yeah,
show.
Yeah, I remember that.
And so that was when I opened up with different music. Like, okay, I don't have to listen to what's on the radio. Like, there's this other shit to go find
right
there. And then I saw U2 on Tom Snyder when I was in, I guess, ninth grade. And that was it. I mean, that's when I was like, even in ninth grade, I was like, those guys can't even play. And they're awesome. Like, you know, it was like, that didn't intimidate me. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so
right.
That got me. And then I had a brother who went to college that year, and he was bringing back all these punk records that I'd missed along the way, you know, because I was... Back then, you didn't. I mean, there was one record store in my town in the mall, and they just had the biggest stuff. You'd order.
Yeah, what were those called? Like Licorice?
Record Bar.
Oh, Record Bar. They had these ones like, you know, Licorice Records. Or, I don't know.
Strawberries.
They had all these dumb chains.
Peaches and Cats was in Nashville. I was an hour north of Nashville, is where I grew up. So, you know, by the time I was ninth or tenth grade, I was into bands that were smaller, and I started thinking, like, man, that's just what, I mean, I always wanted to be a drummer, but I was obsessed with Ringo when I was a little kid. And I'm at A and they're at Z. I didn't know there was a 24 letters in between. It's just like, well, I'm not in the Beatles, so I'm never going to play drums.
Yeah, right.
I didn't think you could start your own band and figure it out as a kid. So it wasn't something I told my parents, like, I want to play drums, and they went, okay, whatever. But if I had obsessively pursued it, it would have worked out, but I didn't. And when I got to college, my freshman year, I met a guy who had a kit, and I would start playing it. And my New Year's Eve of my freshman year of college, me and one of my brothers and some friends played at a party. We just learned like five Ramones songs and three Clash songs, and we played them all six times.
That's dope.
And Twist and Shout and You Can't Do That, two Beatles songs. And we went and played this party at a house in Nashville. And, I mean, the guitar player could play and the bass player could play. And then my brother sang and he was faking it. And I was the drummer and I was faking it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I did that one party and that was it. I was like, we got to do this again. And I said, I was 18, freshman in college. I was like, that's it. I'm doing this.
Yeah.
And over the next 2 years, I played exactly two more New Year's Eve parties. That was it.
Wow.
Didn't do a thing about it. But it was in me, and I was going to see gigs all the time. I was going to Nashville on weekends.
That's blowing my mind because you're so good. You know?
I was starting my fourth year of college, and a friend of mine I'd grown up with, he had moved to Atlanta, and he said, I'm starting this band. Come on, come do it with me. And I was just looking for a reason to drop out. And I said, yeah, I'm there. I'm down. And so I dropped out at Christmas of my fourth year of college, moved to Atlanta in February, and me and the two guys I was going to start a band with moved into a house with Chris Robinson. They already knew him, so there was four of us in a house.
Wow.
And so this band was called Marry My Hope that I went down there and started.
Right.
And Sven Pipien, who's been in the Crows since 97, he was the bass player.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so Sven and then our buddy Clint and I, and then a kid that I knew from college, I got him to move down from Kentucky too. James Hall, who still makes records.
What style was it?
Marry My Hope was like very much, it was, you know, at the time, it was funny. Like, a lot of Zeppelin with a lot of like Bauhaus. You know what I mean? It was like let's really rock. It was very much by design not Georgia 1987.
Right.
Like, no jangle, no fucking Southern indie, no REM or DBs or Let's Active or none of the shit was going on then. The idea was let's get heavy. I mean, almost like, you know, I mean, Jane's Addiction, probably similar, you know, just a really artistic, I mean.
Which, like, Jane's was Zep, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, just talking about that.
It was just a lot of the same places, you know, coming from. And we started that band and played maybe two. The first show we ever played was opening for Mr. Crow's Garden.
Yeah.
So Chris was 19 or 20. Rich was still in high school. And so they had a different rhythm section every 2 months. They were just, you know,
just a high school band.
It was a high school band, and they took it very seriously. But you know, I mean, Rich is going to school every day. It wasn't like he could do anything. But that, you know, his thing was, I'm going to at least finish high school. So that was that May of '87. So I'd been there 2 months, and then and I bought my first kit when I got there. So I mean, I just had been playing with any regularity. Like, I would only play when the house was empty, because I didn't want to play in front of other guys, because I didn't want them to know I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah, they'd be like, hey, this guy's actually terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? What kind of kit did you buy?
I bought a Pearl Export kit.
Yeah.
I walked into
Blue Collar Rock.
I walked into Rhythm City with $700. I got to Atlanta with $1,200, and within about a month, I was down to $700. I still hadn't bought a kit. I was like, fuck. I bought a kit. I walked in with $700 bills, and I walked out. And that receipt, which I had for years and lost, was $699.99.
Wow.
I mean, just said sucker on my head as loud as it could go. You know, I said, I need everything I'm going to need for a gig. I don't have one. I don't even have a stick. I don't have any equipment, you know. And I bought a kit, and then the Zildjian, like, scimitar set of cymbals, these starter cymbals. Real cheap hardware.
Yeah.
And then just...
Just that Chinese hardware falls apart.
I had enough to get started, and that's all it took. And so I did a couple gigs with this band, Marry My Hope. I think we did three shows, and then Mr. Grow's Garden had, through some bizarre happenstance, somebody at A&M here in LA had heard a demo they'd made, and he called him and said, let's go in the studio, I'll give you $5,000 and I'll send you to go to North Carolina with this producer. And their drummer had just quit to join a local band called Driving and Crying.
Yeah.
They had just signed to Island. So it was like, you know, there's Chris and Rich, and they didn't have a bass player, they didn't have anything. And Chris just said, just come and do this demo with us. And I said, dude, I've had a drum kit for like 3 months. I can't do a demo for A&M
insane.
Records. I mean, it was like asking me to join the FBI. I was like, it's
for the NFL.
It's a record label. I can't do that.
Yeah.
You know? But that was the first time I was ever in a studio, and I was scared to death. I mean, I was so intimidated by all the knobs. Just like I'd never seen a desk.
Yeah.
You know, just looking
of course.
At it. And we drove to Chapel Hill to Steve Gronbach's. He had done a Rain Parade record, and we loved the Rain Parade. And Chris, I guess because he had worked with the Rain Parade, Chris said, let's work with that guy, you know, and the A&R guy from A&M Records at the time knew Gronbach. So anyway, we went up there and did a tune, and then just live, just to have like better sounding than normal demos. We did like three or four of the songs that we had.
What songs?
That they had. I wasn't even in the band yet.
Yeah.
I was the roommate who had a drum kit. That's why I was there.
You remember what songs they were?
Yeah, the one we did was called Gravedigger Blues. Like, we turned that was the finished product.
Right.
And then there was a song called This Ain't No Election. There was one called Take This Regret. There was one called The Payment, maybe. It didn't make sense why it was called something that had nothing to do with the lyrics. So Glory, Your Definition, Not My Ambition, something like that. So we had three or four songs we did. And we came back to Atlanta, and then when we got back to Atlanta, at that point I had just moved out of this house where the four of us lived. And we had a house in Atlanta where there was two bands lived there and rehearsed, and a bunch of friends. It was just the flop house for a bunch of local musicians. And I had just moved out because I took some dude's apartment for the summer. He was going to London for the summer, so I took his apartment, and I was like, yeah, nice. And then me and Chris went to that apartment, and he goes, well, why don't you just join our – just play with us, man. And it's funny because the first thing I said was, I can't – I fucking hate your brother.
Oh, and
goes,
Rich?
And he goes, everybody does. Don't worry about it. And I was like – and he goes and I was like, well, it's not so much that I hate him. It's just you guys are such – I don't want to get in between. You know, you guys fucking hate each other's guts, but then if anybody goes at one of you, then it's just fight.
Straight hillbilly, right?
I could see the whole thing. I could just see what that dynamic was. And I was like, I got my own band. I'm going to join – two brothers who were always trying to kill each other. And I mean, I just was like, I don't dig it.
Even back then, huh?
Oh, yeah, right away. And you know, and Rich had a problem with me just because I was Chris's new best friend all of a sudden.
Oh, yeah.
And then, and I mean, this is all we've talked, I mean, this is so far ago, but it was just what it was. And then, and I'm just sitting there going, what? But, you know, but all this to say, the first night I got to Atlanta, like go back in time 4 months, Mr. Crow's Garden played my second night in town. And I saw, I didn't know what it was. It was just, I met this dude, Chris, and he was really funny, and we hit it off right away. And the next night, his band was playing a show. And I went and watched them, and they were fucking awful. They barely play. But I mean, but I thought they're, I mean, looking back, they're like awful. Like, you know, but, yeah. But I saw right away in Chris, and he had a really, his voice was really high, and it was just a whole nothing like what people would associate with him because he was 19. But the charisma, the X factor, all that shit was so there. I just went, that fucking guy's a star. Like,
wow.
Holy shit.
You can see that, right? Like, I would see guys back in the day.
Oh, absolutely.
In clubs, and you'd see one guy, and you go, this fucking guy, man.
Well, you'd see guys who were incredible singers and players, and so what? And then you'd see, I saw Mr. Crow's Garden, and I was like, that's horrible, but it's everything you need. It's just because they haven't done it enough.
It's just rock.
And then they asked me to join, and I was like, God, I'm even worse than you guys. I mean, it's, you know, I'm not acting like I was any better. I was the worst guy by far. But, you know, and I always said back then, we were the worst band in Atlanta and the best band in the world.
That's like, hilarious.
I mean, we sucked, but we knew where we were going to get somewhere good. And the thing that we all had in common, though, because that very night when I said, I'm not going to play, I don't like Rich, and then we talked about it, and I was like, well, I guess I don't dislike him. I just, he doesn't fucking say anything. Like,
yeah, right?
I remember going, like, guy didn't talk to me. And he's like, he doesn't talk to anybody. If you join the band, it'll be, you know, and then it was fine. I mean, me and Rich, I mean, we were never like super tight friends back in those days, but we didn't really have any animosity at all. It was just, he's fucking Chris's brother. The guy didn't have a chance.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. What is the thing with Rich? Is he just, because when, like, I remember when I tweeted.
Well, back then, he was. I think it's just, I mean, by nature, just a quiet guy. And then his brother, if he wanted to say something, he never had room anyway. I mean, Chris never shuts up.
Yeah.
I mean, just they're exactly as people imagine them to be, like, you know, just in their personality. And so when Chris was away, when Chris would leave, all of a sudden you'd have these really long conversations with Rich. But if Chris was in a room, the guy never said a word.
Yeah.
And that goes back to 3 and 1 years old.
I mean,
that's just life for them. So.
Yeah. Brothers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Brothers.
I mean, I mean, fuck, I got 5 brothers. I understand full well being in a band. I mean, I've always said we get along great, but if we were in a band, somebody would have been dead.
Oh, yeah,
that's
right.
That's how it works.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, bands are the worst because when you're out on the road, it's just after a while, it's like, I hate when you do that. It just melts down.
Oh, everything. And those guys never had, you know, I mean, the first time we played a show, the first gig I played with them was in Jacksonville Beach, Florida. That we opened for Gordon Gano, the guy from the Violent Femmes, in like June of 87. And me and Chris stayed over the next extra night because we wanted to see the Long Riders, who were there the next night.
Oh, yeah.
And we got back from that trip, and then I was officially, okay, I'm in this band. And it's funny because at the time, the thing that really was is, I like the band I was starting, Marry My Hope, it was just like a... It was all just drugs, and acid, and let's get fucking weird. And Mr. Crow's Garden at the time, it was like me and Chris were just drinking beer.
Yeah.
It was like, let's just get drunk. And it was like, honestly, looking back, I was like, I'm more of a drinker than a drugger.
You know what I mean?
And it's funny that, you know, to think that the Black Crows were the less druggy of the two
bands. That's hilarious, right?
As it turns out. But, you know, there was just a copacetic mindset between me and the two brothers, which was just, we take this so seriously that we're not going to take it seriously. I mean, we always had long term, but day to day, making a plan and following through meant nothing to us.
Like,
and that was totally, I mean, we were as much as, like, you know, we would go out. That was 87. In 88, the first time we played New York is when we met George Jacoulias.
Right.
And we did a Stooges song and an Aerosmith song and 8 originals.
Wow.
And the first thing George said was, great covers, but and your songs suck. But man, Stooges and Aerosmith in 1988, who's doing that?
That's fucking hilarious. So, like, what are you guys playing back then?
We did, like, Down on the Street, or maybe 1969 by the Stooges. We did a few Stooges songs, and we did No More, No More.
You know, right. What a weird thing to play. Great song, right?
But, and in fact, we actually did Mama Kin too. And I, you know, which in the scene we were in, those were like, we might as well have been playing like death metal. You know, it's like, why are you playing Aerosmith? You know?
Yeah.
So we were into rock music, but it was more the mindset and the aesthetic was pure Replacements. I mean, we went back and we're playing more, we're thinking about stuff from farther back, but our worldview was total Replacements.
That's like, crazy to think about, right?
Yeah. Oh, that
because you know, when does the Faces come in? Because once the first record comes out, it's 100% Faces.
And it was, that had nothing to do with our, I mean, we were Faces fans like we were anything, you know, but the I mean, if you ask me, I mean, way more Stones always than Faces. Yeah. But that was just as simple as when Rich started going to fucking around with open tunings. And then George, we were working with George DeCoulias and started doing demos with him because he was with A&M Records too back then and was interested in doing, and they weren't interested in us. And when he left and came to L.A. to start with Deaf America, and that's when he was able to sign us.
So you do the A&M demos and then they pass
nothing,
on
yeah,
you.
Yeah, they just said, we'll stay in touch, but nothing yet.
Right, right. And did they hold you down like 5-6 months, you know, like a demo deal or
No, nothing at all.
No, it's just you went in and did them, they didn't like it, and you moved on.
They paid for a couple trips to a studio and they said, I mean, the guy, the dude was like, let's stay in touch. Send me more songs.
Who was the guy? Aaron Jacobus? Yeah, oh, Aaron. God. It's so fucking crazy. He signed me to Virgin.
Really?
Unbelievable.
Yeah. And I saw, last time I saw Aaron was
he's
like,
great guy.
Was like 1988.
I saw him a month ago.
And then I was here in 2002 and 3 working with a kid named Joe Firstman doing just recording, writing. He was writing all these songs. He had a deal. And I'd bump into Aaron Jacobus then and I was like, you know, back then, 10 years was 50 years. You know what I mean? So when I saw Aaron, it was like I was looking at someone from a different lifetime ago.
Yeah.
And if I saw him now, I'd be like, what's up, dude? You know, but Aaron was totally cool. We just figured, well, fuck him. He doesn't want us, then, you know.
Yeah. That's how you look at an A&R guy, right?
That was every one of those guys. George was the only guy we ever met that we immediately clicked with. And he's the first guy who said, you guys suck, but I could totally tell you got all you know, you just got to get there. But we trusted George. We didn't trust a single other person we ever met.
That's amazing that he liked you and you guys sucked. You know what I mean? Because that was such a hard...
He saw what I saw. You see Chris and... It was a different vibe, but there was just something there. You were like, okay, it's not found its form yet, but there's something special in it.
Right, yeah.
And the rest of us, I mean, I'm sure looking back, we were all interchangeable except for Chris at the time.
Yeah.
But it was obvious Chris was a band. It was a band. I mean, there was no getting around that. It was like there was at least three of us that were like down for whatever.
Right.
And it was, and at that time we had different bass players all the time. It was a four piece.
Yeah, before Johnny Colt.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then Johnny joined right as we made the record. I mean, he was the last guy in.
And what about Mark? When does Mark come in?
Mark came in after the Shake Your Moneymaker tour. So, I mean.
Oh, that's right. Because I saw you guys at the Stone and you had the other dude.
Yeah, Jeff Sees.
Yeah.
Who now is lead guitarist for Eric Church for many years.
Wow.
Yeah, Jeff's a Nashville guy.
And so you guys go cut the demos with George.
We did demos with George. A&M didn't like him. And then he said, look, I'm going to go to Deaf American with Rick and we'll make a record. This is all by late 88. He said, let's do it. And he said, spring of 89, we'll make a record in L.A. And we were just like, L.A.? Like, that's another planet, man.
Yeah,
let's go. And it ended up being the summer of 89 in Atlanta, which we were bummed out about. But we went in and made the record. And that record was so far above what we thought we were capable of. You know, I mean, because we'd never been in a studio with time. And we never, you know, we put everything we possibly, that was as good as that possibly could have been. It was the best thing we had in us.
How long did it take you to record it?
Probably 3 weeks.
Wow.
And we didn't get a thing the first week because we didn't know. We were looking back. We were so intimidated and we didn't communicate well and we didn't understand. Like, I mean, the most basic thing George would say, we were trying to play to a click track, which I'd never done. And I'd still only been playing for 2 years. I mean, I'm still just like every day.
Two years in, you got a record deal.
I'm looking at the door every day going, I know there's a ringer coming in here. I mean, I'm the first guy they're going to bounce. And, I mean, we had probably been tracking or trying to track for 4 days or 5 days and did not have one take that we were like, we knew we have a song done. And George is thinking like, fuck, he understood he was great because he could have brought in a drummer and it would have been like that.
Right.
And it was a simple thing as he kept saying, man, you're falling off the click track. You keep falling off the click track. And it took 5 days for me to finally go, there's no fucking way I'm falling off the click track. I'm flying. He goes, yeah, you're getting ahead of it. And I go, well, then say I'm getting ahead of it.
Yeah. He makes it sound like you're falling behind.
I go, I'm speeding up. He goes, yeah, I know. I go, because you're telling me I'm falling off. And he goes, falling off doesn't mean slowing down. I go, yes, it does.
It does.
It literally took 5 days to have that conversation.
Which is like a lot of studio money.
It was unbelievable. And wow. Then we, all of a sudden, we start getting tracks because I was like, oh, okay. I mean, yeah. And I mean, shit, I was 23. George was 24.
That's hilarious. I mean, right? We were just 24-year-old guy kids. Producing records. What yeah. did he do before that? That made you.
Well, we didn't know who he, we just loved him. I mean, give a shit. I mean, we found out who he was later. The first time we met him in New York, literally one night, we were like, we're working with that guy. Done. No matter what, he's a producer. He's at A&M Records. He's hilarious. He's our age. We had all the same reference points culturally.
Yeah.
We'll work with this guy. And then we found out, his connection to Rick Rubin. They were roommates at NYU.
Right.
And then, the Electric, the Cult record that had come out. Oh, I mean, there's...
Masterpiece.
He was... Everything Rick had done up to that point was George.
Yeah, that's why they all had that great kind of dry, cool sound.
Yeah.
You know, they all had the records, the Danzig record, the Cult. I think he did that one record. What was that band? They had the chick on slide. Pearly! He did that record, too. That's a great...
Raging
Slab. So yeah. He had done some fantastic style music. They all had a style, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of those bands had, like, a shtick. You know, there was, like, a thing. And where we went afoul with Rick Rubin, because we never met Rick until the record was about to come out.
I heard. Like, he didn't even know you were on the label, right?
No, he had nothing to do with anything. I guess Chris did the vocals in L.A. We tracked it in Atlanta. Chris came to L.A. to sing, and he met Rick. The rest of us didn't meet Rick until it was already finished and mastered and everything. And, I mean, to us, it's just funny, but people want to make a big deal of it. But, Rick had a very different expectation of what a Southern band should be.
Right.
And we were like, fuck yourself. I don't know. We're not that.
What was he looking for, Allman Brothers?
He wanted like, overalls and literal straw, hay in our teeth. And
yeah, that's Raging Slab, right?
No, exactly.
Like a look that, floppy hat.
He wanted like that shit kicker look. And it was like, dude, you're talking about a bunch of kids who, I mean, me and the Robinson brothers, we all went to private schools and we like Paul Westerberg and the Paisley Underground. And I'm in a band because of R.E.M. first and foremost.
Yeah.
Like that was my... I got obsessed with R.E.M. when Chronic Town came out, and that was it. Like R.E.M. and U2 and the beat, like that was the shit that I was listening to. And I said, okay, by God, I'm going to go do this.
Right.
It had nothing to do with rock.
That's weird to
nothing
think about,
all.
Right? Because no. I think that's how you get an organic sound. Because if you're
Rich and I are self-taught, and we both were learning how to play and playing together. And
right.
That's all we, I've had one drum lesson and it was like 5 years ago.
Wow.
It was great. I was like, hey, that helped. and it was just, that's why Rich started fucking around with open tunings. He was listening to the Stones and listening to like Nick Drake records. And it was like, why, the minute he dawned on, like someone explained it to him, tuned open G, tuned to E or whatever. All of a sudden, he's like, oh, hey, well, that's what it took for him to just take this big step forward.
Right.
And it just, boom, and like all these, like, I can remember, we had a million songs back then. The rule in Mr. Groh's Garden was every time we wrote any song, an old song got kicked out.
Is that right?
Like if you saw that band in Atlanta in 1988, if you saw us every 6 weeks, it was like a whole different set. Like we had a handful of songs we kept, and the rest would just be gone, gone, gone.
Wow. But that's great.
It was.
It's like writing jokes.
He wrote, exactly.
You're just filtering in stuff, and stuff stays, and other stuff goes.
And he wrote, Stuck's Angels was, I think, of the stuff on Shake Your Money Maker, that was the oldest one. Like,
wow.
He wrote that, and we were like, that sounds like a real song.
Right?
That's fucking...
I mean, wow. you when you're tracking that song, you know, that's during the 80s ballad era.
Yeah.
You got to think this thing's going to smash.
Not at all, actually, because, we were so – dude, that I was working at a record store called Wax and Facts in Little Five Points back then. And I thought the record was done because we weren't going to do Angels. And George calls the store and he goes, can you come in? We're going to do that ballad. And I go, well, I'm working today. He goes, well, just come over for an hour,
what?
Like that. And I left the store, drove to the studio. We cut Angels, and I had to go right back to work. I didn't think about it twice.
Wow.
And you got to understand, too, in 1989, if you put on MTV or rock radio, man, it was hair bands, and it was...
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, we were like from such a... I mean, as much as that record sounds like the old classic rock, I mean, that was not our headspace at
right.
all. As far as like just vibe wise and mindset and what it means, you know, we were very serious people. I mean, everything that was on MTV then, I thought was the worst shit I'd ever heard.
Yeah, I remember, you know, specifically.
We liked Guns N' Roses. You know, Guns N' Roses was acceptable.
Yeah,
because I wasn't necessarily into such hard stuff. I've never have been. But it was real. Like that, yeah. Okay, that's not bullshit.
Yeah.
All that other LA shit is bullshit. That was my mindset anyway. It was everybody's. It was just like, but when Johnny showed up, he was totally down with the rock shit. Like he was of that mindset. But we needed that. It was the perfect, you know, he brought a lot of that to the table and was, you know, like, okay, because we were also getting to the point where, well, those guys can at least all play. Because we were coming from a place where it didn't matter if you could play or not.
Yeah.
It was just all about, are you hip and cool?
Yeah.
And that wasn't going to be our bag. And then we weren't going to be like, you know, Queensryche. You know, just like we didn't know where we were.
Yeah, because that was Silent Lucidity right then.
I mean, we weren't like that kind of player band.
Yeah.
We didn't know what we were, but we were just... We fucking meant it. That's all I knew, you know?
That's interesting. No game plan. You weren't like, okay, we're going to be like Faces, Stones.
God, no. We had... We finished that record like in July. We signed the deal in October.
Yeah.
We got $1,000 each.
Whoa.
That was it. we met our manager in December.
Pete Angelus?
Yeah. He flew to Atlanta. We met him on December 20th, and the record came out in February.
Yeah.
There was no plan. When I say there's no plan, there was no plan. I mean, George effectively was managing us because he knew. We figured, well, he knows everybody. He'll figure it out. And Doc McGee, all the big rock managers were sent the record. All of them passed.
Wow.
Nobody heard it. And Pete heard it and said, that's fucking great.
Wow. That's amazing because he's with David Lee Roth.
Yeah.
He really doesn't have any other bands at the time.
Right.
And now he has mad fucking knowledge.
He came to Atlanta. We met him. And it was just like meeting George. Like, we had met a bunch of other managers. And we were just like, no, no, no. And we sat with him. And in 5 minutes. And again, like, Dave... super successful, but we had nothing to do with that aesthetic.
That was like he was a clown.
You know?
Yeah, of course.
And we wouldn't have even at that time said Van Halen was any good. We were just in such a different place. And so we were very skeptical about their manager coming in. This guy who's like David Lee, he directs those videos. Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, right.
And we met him, and in 5 minutes we were all like, this is the dude.
That's incredible. And what did he what made him the dude? He came in and you knew he listened to the record.
He knew the record very well, but he was just so pitbull, laser focus. He's the only guy who ever came in and said, we would say shit to people like this. All right, well, what would you do? And they could have said anything, and we would have been like, okay, because we didn't know. We were acting like we were. And he goes, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. And he just talked, and he 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 talked. And we were like, oh shit, he's serious. Like, this guy.
Wow.
And he's a great storyteller. He's a really funny guy.
Yep.
But he was so bright and so, again, it was just, you sense in people, what brought me and Chris and Rich together was, for me and Chris, it was just sense of humor. I'm very dry. He's bouncing off the walls, and we just made each other laugh. I mean, literally, that was the connection, is we were the funniest guy that each other knew, right? That was our thing. And with Rich, it was just, I think Rich liked me just because he could tell I was serious. Like, I dropped out of college and moved to Atlanta and bought a drum kit with no plan B. I just said, fuck it, I'm doing this.
That's the best,
And the thing with my first band, you know, it's funny because Marry My Hope, the band I left, they got signed before Mr. Grows Garden did.
Really?
They actually got a deal.
Whoa, what label?
Silvertone. They made their first record in fucking London.
Wow.
They fly to London to make an album, and I'm like,
that's got to feel weird, right? You leave the band and they get a deal.
Yeah, and Sven and Clint and James, and then the other drummer, his name was Steve too, the guy that replaced. They're all in London for a month, and I'm like, Jesus, man, way to go. They were great. Marry My Hope, that first record was great. I loved it. But it was one of those things. It was once I decided to leave, it was just so clear, like, that aesthetic was not me at all.
Right,
you know, I was
right.
in the right place. But, you know, we were just, like I said, like, I think the thing with me and Rich, we both just had this, we're going to do that. You know, if the door opens, we're going to run through it.
Yeah.
But we're not going to claw our way through it because there's, we didn't understand. Like, Pete was talking about MTV, and I was looking at him like, MTV? Are you fucking kidding me?
That shit's lame.
How do you, no, but I mean, how do you even get on MTV? Oh, it was like from another universe.
Right.
Like,
I get you.
And talking about like rock radio, and I'm like, rock radio is all Bon Jovi and shit. What the fuck are you talking about? But he kept saying, he goes, no, man, this record is going to cut through a ton of shit. We were making Shake Your Money Maker at a time when everyone sold a shitload of records.
Yeah.
And my mantra was 50,000. Just please sell 50,000 because they'll have to let us make another one.
Yeah.
That's all I thought that was going to do. Because MTV and rock radio, there was nothing that sounded or looked like us or felt like us. And then, you know, so when the record came out, right away, Jealous Again went to rock radio, which rock radio, you know.
Yep.
You know.
Yeah.
No one else does. It's under 40. Used to be dominant. It was it. You just had rock and pop. That was it,
man.
And rock radio jumped all the fuck over that record. And we were, believe me, we ran with it, but we were stunned. I mean, it was a complete, like, you got to be fucking kidding me. We played, the day we met Pete, all right, that record came out in February. We played the Cotton Club in Atlanta in December. It was a showcase because, I mean, the guy, Charlie Brusco or whoever was running it, not Charlie Brusco, what's his name? Dan Nolan, gave us the room on a Sunday night right before Christmas because we had a management showcase, and he just said, yeah, you can come do it. No cover charge. First draft beer was free. Oh. There was 11 people there.
Oh, man. Ghost Town.
That's us in our hometown 2 months before that record came out.
Insane. Eleven people.
And one of them was my mom. We were nowhere.
Wow.
The Black Crowes couldn't get her fucking rested.
Wow.
It's true.
11 people.
And, I mean, it was just... And Pete came back afterwards, and he was like, okay, let's go talk, you know. And he said, and I mean, ultimately, what he said in a manner of speaking was same thing George said, which was, okay, this is awful, but you have all the pieces, you just don't know what to do with them. You know what I mean? Like really, it's like everything I'm ever going to need to work with is here. Let me show you how this goes.
Right.
You know, you have to have a little bit of professionalism. And we were chafe at that. And he's like, he goes, I don't mean like bow in between songs like the Beatles. I mean fucking just... You have to address the crowd at least once a night. Chris would never speak to the audience back then. Never say a fucking word.
Yeah.
He would never even engage them. We were on stage. It was intense and we were going for it, but it was very insular. It was like, we're in our own world up here.
Was he nervous or just cocky? Like, was it that? Like,
it's both. They're the same thing. You know, arrogance and fear, they're intertwined, you know?
Yeah, because I mean, Jim didn't talk to the crowd either, like Morrison, and, you know, some singers get away with it.
There was a time when Chris was a tremendous, I mean, when he was a world-class classic rock frontman.
Right.
In the early 90s, when it clicked for him, you know, a few months into Shake Your Money Maker through the Southern Harmony Tour. So for three years, he was a frontman I would put up next to anybody that's ever done it.
That's right.
And then he didn't care. I mean, he just wanted to do something different. He didn't want to be that guy. But the truth is, he didn't start off wanting to be that guy. I mean, he did it for a while and it worked, but it really wasn't him, you know?
Right.
And, you know, not that I know exactly what he fucking is, but that the idea of getting out there and, you know, he was never a guy that had the same shit between songs every night. Like, he never did that stuff. And
that's that canned banter.
He would engage the crowd, but then, you know, if he didn't like the crowd, he'd fucking tell them. You know, I mean, there's never any showbiz.
Yeah, right.
You
know, he is pretty gangster.
So there was a lot of, but, you know, we had a lot of strengths and we had a lot of weaknesses. And what Pete did, which was his job, was he told us how to, okay, let's eliminate those weaknesses and focus on your strengths. And within a matter of months, and plus we'd only played, you know, we'd go out and play three gigs on a weekend twice a month at most, ever, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, when we started the Shake Your Money Maker tour, we hadn't played 100 gigs as a band
in
3 years.
And who were you going out with when you first went out?
Junkyard first.
Oh, great band, man.
We started at in Anaheim. First show we drove from Atlanta to LA.
God, that had to be a lot of booze on that tour.
Oh my God.
Cuz David, the singer, David Roach, was straight full-blown alcoholic.
We played our third show with them was in Tijuana. Well, it was 100
at the iguana.
It was 100 feet past the border. It wasn't exact. You know, I'm picturing like Mexico.
Yeah, yeah.
And we just went into a strip mall. And okay, it's not quite the same. But we played that night, and anybody that was in the Black Crowes at the time remembers it so clearly. But he came running out to start the set, like they were rocking, and he comes out from the side to grab that mic and give it a good scream.
Yeah.
And just misjudged. There was a 6-foot drop to a concrete floor, and he just went right over. And he bounced up, and his fucking face was bleeding, and he was so drunk he didn't even notice.
Man,
awesome dude.
That guy was great.
Yeah, he was great.
They had that.
They were super cool dudes. They
super
treated us
cool.
Great. And the record, like we did 6 weeks. We started in Anaheim, we played in Portland, Maine, and we finished in Ventura. So we went everywhere in between in 6 weeks.
Wow,
crossing back. And by the time the tour ended, after 6 weeks, our record was blowing up.
Yeah.
You know, and they were on their second album, and it was just sitting there. And it got a little chippy in the last week because, they were just like, oh, fuck. We got to some clubs, and they'd switch the marquee.
Man.
And we were not at all like, ha-ha. I mean, we weren't acting like that.
Yeah.
But we were also very, We it was funny. Like I said, we'd only played maybe 100 gigs. When we went to playing every night, like there was hardly ever days off.
Yeah.
When we got that in us, when we got 30 gigs under our belt like that, we were like, it was like single A to the major. I mean, we fucking took off.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So like, in 6 months' time, we were out like opening for Robert Plant. And when that was happening, we were good. I mean, we were already a good band, and we were not that when we started.
I remember the time I was in San Fran, and you're right. It's just kind of this, it's the tail end of kind of the MTV era.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden Black Crowes come around and London Choir Boys, mm-hmm. and it was this different thing. Like, whoa, what is this? And then later Blind Melon,
Well, Choir Boys, we were in L.A. before the first tour, and they were at the Roxy one night. We went to see them, and they were shtick.
Yeah,
that wasn't real. That was a bunch of horse shit. And we were very much like, oh, God, this is who we're getting lumped in. Like, the Rolling Stone review was those two albums in one review.
Yeah, right?
Which we were not happy about. It was like, God damn, man. I guess we went a little... We shouldn't have ripped off Sway quite so obviously. You know what I mean? It was like, oh, fuck.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess Sway and Tumbling Dice, we should have gone a little deeper into the catalog.
It's so funny.
But we saw right through that, like, and I can remember, like, when Amorica came out, we were in London, and Spike, or one of those guys, was at one of the gigs. He came to see us, and we were like, oh, it's the dude from the Choir Boys.
Yeah.
And I remember him saying, he was like, I can't believe you guys made it, and we didn't. And we were literally just laughing, going,
yeah,
are you serious?
Yeah,
you guys suck. You were like a total joke. You were put together in a 70s laboratory somewhere. Like,
it's
you weren't
so funny.
Real.
Also, they're from London. They weren't over here London. Just grinding it out.
And they were all their songs were about, let's go to the party. You know, I mean, it was like the difference in everything about the two bands. We were like, but, you know, I mean, I remember when Amorica came out and reading reviews about, oh, just more of the faces. And I'm like, yeah, whatever.
No,
they're going to always write what they write.
Yeah, of course. So after the first record blows up, does Rick Rubin start to show interest, or is he still like, I don't know about those guys?
Oh, no. I mean, he was very interested. I mean, we paid for their nice offices in Burbank.
Yeah, you know, I understand
now,
that.
No, he was never going to work with us.
Yeah,
there was never a sense or a question of we'll make a record with Rick. If he ever felt that way, he never expressed it, and we would have never, ever in a million years gone for it.
Oh, yeah? Why is that?
We didn't like him. I mean,
yeah, because I always hear Chris say he doesn't like Rick at all.
Well, he came to Atlanta. You know, the first time we met him, I mean, he said you should call yourselves the Cobb County Crows and spell it with K's, the KKK.
Wow.
He was dead serious.
Really?
So I'm never going to take that guy seriously again. It's like, go fuck yourself. This is my life, and this is our band. And thanks for the $60,000 to make the record, but go fucking die.
Is that how much that record costs?
Yeah.
That's great.
And we were, you know, I mean, when a guy sits you down and says that to you.
Yeah. Call your band KKK.
We were just like, okay, go away.
Yeah.
You're coming here. I mean, I remember I said at the time, I said, it's an interesting thing for a Jew from Long Island who produces rap records to say to a bunch of Southerners.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to assume you're going to be like, you know, I could have made a lot of assumptions about your worldview from your thing.
Yeah.
Who the
He's just assuming you guys are Southern hillbillies,
well, yeah,
and this would be just funny spin on your vibe.
I mean, I never owned, to this day, I've never owned a Lynyrd Skynyrd record.
Right.
I love all the old records, but I've heard them a million times, but I didn't grow up listening to anything that would even constitute an ounce of Southern rock.
Right.
And when I did, you know, to me, like the Allman, you know, Southern rock has nothing to do with the Allman Brothers, and it has nothing to do with REM. Those are the two Southern bands that I love the most.
Right.
Southern rock is a pigeonholed vibe.
Yeah.
Where
Molly Hatchet was Southern rock.
Exactly. Like that's guys who are taking, they're seeing what's happening and going, we can water that down a little bit and play up the shtick a little more, and that's Southern rock to me. That's what Skynyrd became. They weren't in the 70s. They were just a fucking great rock
band.
Just a rock band. They were incredible. You know, like I hear Lynyrd Skynyrd, I hear Free.
Yeah, you're right.
You hear so much English stuff and so many other elements that, you know, and things change over time and whatever, but the Rick was expecting us to, you know, who knows? But I didn't like hate Rick at all. I mean, I personally always got along with him great. He's hilarious. He's got great stories. He's fucking Rick Rubin. We've got a problem.
Right,
with
right. Exactly.
Shine on, brother.
Yeah.
But as far as working with us, that was just immediately never going to be an option.
Right.
It was like, no.
Now, let's get into the Southern Harmony record, which is fucking masterpiece. I mean, I love all the records up to By Your Side. And I can't, because I played music, and I was playing music at the time you guys were going.
Yeah.
And I couldn't fathom how this band that wrote Shake Your Moneymaker, which is kind of a Stones Faces record, when this Southern Harmony record comes out, it pretty much changes my life at the time. I was like, the fuck is it? The look, the Mark Seliger cover, the My Morning Song, the long songs, the sound of it, everything blew my mind. How did this come about? Like, I mean, you guys start demoing and you start changing?
No. I mean, it was, again, we played 350 gigs.
Right.
And we were the band that, you know, to this day, but back then we'd play the gig even as we started getting bigger. Like by the end of the Shake Your Moneymaker tour, we're doing theaters with opening, you know, we were headlining the Greek and shit here in LA. We were doing big business on our own. We were the band that would play a show, go backstage. If there was a meet and greet, we'd do it. If there was people that were there for a bit of a party, we'd have it. But we'd get on the bus and listen to live Zeppelin bootlegs.
Wow, really?
We'd listen to Little Feet. That's what we did.
I got all the Zepp bootlegs
here. That's what we did at night. We didn't stay in town and try to pull chicks and see who could get the drunkest. We got on the bus and drank ourselves to sleep listening to live bootlegs of great bands.
That's great, right? There's nothing like being on a bus with good records.
That's exactly all we ever did. Like, I mean, there was never a movie showing on our bus in those days. It was just music. We were the only band on tour back then. You'd go into our dressing room. We had a stereo and a road case that was giant.
Yeah.
And other bands would come in and go, oh, man, we should have a stereo. And we'd like, how do you not? You know, little things like that that we were very, very focused on. I mean, I would watch Let There Be Rock, you know, the AC/DC.
So
like
great.
If we were watching a VHS tape, it was a gig.
Right.
And like me, I can remember me and Johnny would watch that all the time because that rhythm section, you want to talk about the simplest rhythm section that nobody else could possibly sound like and replicate. There's so much swing and so much vibe, and it's just so perfect. And Malcolm being the third member of that rhythm section, it's like AC/DC is the hardest band to cover because you can't, just because they are, you can't play like that.
Yeah, once Phil Rudd was out, it was weird.
Swear to God, man, it's easier to cover the Grateful Dead than it is AC/DC.
I believe it.
You cannot sound like AC/DC as much as anyone tries. It's impossible. It's just one of those things to me. So we would watch that over and over and talk about it. And then we would sound check every day. We sound checked every day for 90 minutes.
Wow. Just working on tunes?
Just working on parts and riffs and new grooves. And, you know, we'd have on like an Eric Burden Declares War and like take that groove. And then we'd just be playing a groove. And then everybody would just play over top of it. And eventually all of a sudden everybody would hit something. And those things didn't turn into the songs that everybody knows, but they were always the sketches.
Right.
You know, there was always like a vibe. And then Rich would go away and always come back with a totally different chord arrangement and a different even time. But you know, you could see where it was working. It was very much, the band played so much every day together that it just seeped its way in. It was very osmosis, you know, everything just
right.
And at, towards the end of the Shake Your Moneymaker tour, we weren't, you know, Jeff Cease was miserable. You know, we weren't the right band for. He came from a total punk background,
right?
And he was just on the outs for a variety of reasons, none of which were his fault.
Did Draculius play the leads on the first record?
No, Jeff played.
Oh, he played them. Gotcha.
Jeff played. No, no, Jeff played all the leads except Hard to Handle. The Hard to Handle guitar solo was Brendan O'Brien.
Mm.
Bud was the engineer on that record because he was an Atlanta guy making local records.
Right.
And George came to Atlanta and said, "Do you guys know any engineers?" And I remember, and I said, "Well, the guy that does all the DB records, Brendan, we can call him." And George met Brendan and said, "Are you any good?" And Brendan goes, "Yeah." And he goes, "Okay, you're hired." I mean, it was that, you know, like he knew the studio. He hired him.
Yeah.
And then so when they came to LA to mix Shake Your Moneymaker, Brendan came with them. That's when Brendan met Rick, and Rick hired him to go to Deaf America. And that started his whole...
Yeah.
That got Brendan started. So Brendan played the Hard to Handle guitar solo.
Got you.
Because the one Jeff had... I mean, George and Brendan heard that as a single. We heard it... To us, that was an afterthought. Like, because literally, it went like this. The Otis box set had come out in 89, and we were listening to it obsessively all the time. And we were in pre-production and writing, finishing the songs. And George goes, "You guys should do an Otis song." And Chris goes, "No, I'm not doing a goddamn Otis. Who'd sing an Otis? What kind of asshole sings Otis Redding?"
Yeah, you know, the guy's a king.
Like, why? Do something that you will invariably fail miserably at. You know,
yeah, right.
And that was our thing. It's like, okay, yeah. Like, yeah, I'm going to go try out for the Falcons tomorrow, too.
Yeah,
and
right.
It's like, what? And George said, "No, just find one. We'll do a rock version of it." You know, and it was like, and I don't remember. I really don't. It was either George or Chris said, "Well, what about Hard to Handle?" And we were listening to it, and George goes, "Just straighten it out. Just walk this way it.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like, just
yeah.
do it, you know, walk this way it." And I remember I just played that pattern, and George said, "Just do that. Just keep doing that. The double's doing, dot, dot, just do that." And I was like, okay. You know, I didn't fucking know. I'm just trying to get some noise going. And we just ran through it a few times and never thought about it again. We were in the studio, and George was like, "Let's do the Otis tune. We need it for a B-side." He kept saying that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we're all like, "Well, that'd be cool as a B-side."
Yeah.
And when I got a copy of the finished record, and it was in the set, you know, George came to Atlanta to bring us all. It's so funny, like, I have to bring you your record, you know,
that's
like,
hilarious.
In the old days, and I was like, Hard to Handle can't be on the album. I mean, no sense of commercial, you know, that's how we all were like that.
Yeah,
like, George, it's an Otis song, we don't want that on our record, we want it to be all originals. And he was like, and we listened to the whole thing in order, and we were like, oh, it does fit really nicely there. Still never thinking it would be a single. Why would we put out a single of an Otis record? I mean, clueless as to how the world hears music. We were just in our own world.
That's awesome.
But, you know, but you go forward again. So by the Southern Harmony, you know, like Mad Dogs and Englishmen is the difference from those two records, really. Because we got a hold of that movie and started listening to that, and your double drummer thing. But, I mean, just the vibe of that live, you know, we just came into our own by the end of the Shake Your Moneymaker tour. Like, by the spring and summer and fall of 91, we were like, man, this shit's cooking. And Burning Tree had been out with us, so we knew Mark Ford. They'd opened for us.
Right.
And Jeff wasn't happy, and wasn't working with him, and Burning Tree split, and it wasn't even a discussion or a conversation. It was like, let's call Mark. Okay. And
That easy.
Oh, yeah, because everybody already knew him, and he had jammed with us a bunch and played with us, so we knew he was great. And he flew in. He was back in Orange County working at a record store. Burning Tree had come and gone, and he was just had a job and trying to figure out what to do.
Wow.
And he flew to Atlanta, and we had a week, just all the Southern Harmony tunes. We were running through them with Mark. And, I mean, I don't even think George was there that first week. He wasn't back in town yet. And we just said, we got the guy. It's good. And then George showed up. We did a couple days of pre-production with George. And then we made that record. Fast.
Like, how long? 2 weeks?
My tracks started late Friday night, and I was done Monday.
Wow.
And then I went back 2 days later, and we recut Remedy. But Monday, Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, Monday afternoon, done.
Wow.
And then redid Remedy 2 days later, because we were like, that track's not up to snuff.
Right, right.
But they're all... We played Sometimes Salvation once in the studio. We played Morning Song once in the studio. You know, that was the take you hear. That
one
was
time?
Set up, first pass. We played Morning Song twice and took the first one. We played Sometimes Salvation once.
Jeez.
Like, done. Hotel Illness was like once, done. I mean, it was just, because we were so in the zone. Like,
yeah,
in
yeah.
The way
just
that
playing all the time.
Playing all the time. And, you know, and truthfully, looking back now, it's easy. You know, after the Southern Harmony tour, when Chris moved to L.A., it changed. We did put Amorica together here. We were in L.A., but he was the only one or he and Mark lived here. The rest of us were still back east. And when he left town, it absolutely changed our ability to play year round.
Right.
I mean, now I was pleased as hell to be away from him.
Yeah.
You know, but looking back now, it's like, yeah, we should have all moved here. He should have fucking stayed. Doing the two cities for the band, it really changed things. I mean, I still think we made. I think Amorica and Three Snakes are really good records, but if we'd all just come west with him, or if we had just said, dude, fuck it, come back. But literally, honest to God, we were just thrilled that he was in a different city.
Yeah.
He was driving us fucking nuts.
Well, I mean, everybody that likes the Black Crowes, 100%, Amorica's the record.
Is it?
Absolutely. There's no guy you could talk to out there and go, which Black Crowes record? They're all going to say Amorica and Wiser Time. I mean, by then it becomes...
Well, Wiser Time to me is that's the Black Crowes song. I mean, because of what it means to everybody. And when that record came out, right before it came out, we were playing when we were playing those songs live for the first time before everybody had heard them, you would see in the crowd every night when that song about midway through, it would just, because it was so different, and the audience would be like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
When it hit that chorus for the second time, it would go into the solos. Every night you could just feel, everyone got it. You'd see the light go off in everyone's head.
It's a masterpiece.
And it was like, man, we nailed it. And it should have been the first single. And everything about that record was fucked. The album cover was fucked.
Well, you do a record before that, right? And then it gets scratched.
Tall.
Now you're doing Tall. Like I have the Tall tracks, and I think like Pain and Hate. You know,
no, that's not that. That's Band.
That's Band. Okay,
that's after Three Snakes.
That's after Three Snakes.
Band is the best record we ever made.
That shit is incredible. So when you're doing Tall, it's just a drug haze by then, right?
Yeah, we were at Conway.
Yeah, Conway.
Just fucking shitting money down the toilet.
Wow.
Just paying out the ass for ridiculousness.
And Conway's cool as fuck. It's like a compound.
Yeah, but we've never the best shit. Anytime we were in a nice studio, we never got any work. It sucks. There's no vibe.
Right.
And there was so many. Everyone. I wasn't a coke guy ever. I mean, I did it a few times. It just never clicked. But I was drinking like a fucking asshole.
Right.
And I was like Rich was always. Rich didn't do drugs or drink really at all back then. Never did. I mean, he drinks. He'll have drinks, but he was never, ever fucked up. And just because I was just drinking, I was like the straight thinker compared to that, you know.
Yeah.
The other guy, I mean, I was out of my mind, but I was like way more together than the other guys, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
the other guys, when does it really turn the corner for like Mark and Chris? Because
summer 95.
95. What gets them into, because all of a sudden they're just like full blown, just what, heroin addicts or they're doing coke, mushrooms?
What, it wasn't heroin. It was, I mean, there was some of that, but. I mean, Chris was never a junkie. He was never, ever a big heroin guy. I mean, none of them were at first. I mean, I think Mark and Ed certainly did their share of everything.
Right.
Everybody did everything, but it was never, it was just accumulate. It was the fact that it was everything. It was more like, it wasn't like, let's get heroin. It was just, what do you got?
Yeah, right. You know? Yeah.
But the summer of 95, we toured in Europe. We did the tour with the Stones and a bunch of our own dates. And every day off for 6 weeks, we went to Amsterdam.
I mean,
back then.
You just fly in?
Bus. We were always busing. And we would have 2 or 3 days off. The whole tour hubbed out of Amsterdam.
Oh.
And that, you know, that was just, looking back, I don't even know how to, you know, that's all you got to know.
It was right, like, right. No, I get it.
Drugs were front and center.
But what I'm trying to figure out was it just like, hey, man, we're bored? Or is it like, hey, Stone 72 tour, you know?
All that. No, it was, hey, man, we're bored. It wouldn't have made me roll my eyes so much. I always looked at it, for better or worse, right or wrong, but I was like, stop, you're just playing rock star.
Yeah.
But I didn't understand what addiction was back then either.
Yeah,
I had no clue. I was just like, you guys are fucking this up. Fuck you. You know, like, I'm saying that with 9 Jack and Cokes in me.
Yeah.
But fuck, I'm still playing straight and I'm fucking not, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid to, you know, I'm not canceling gigs. We didn't cancel gigs, but we would like not book things. It was like, no, let's just chill. And, you know, there's just a lot of it. The thing about our band, it's so easy to look back at 49 years old and make sense of it.
Of course.
At the time, it was just from 90 till 2001, despite at the time many moments of feeling like, okay, I'm out of the tunnel now, we were just in a tunnel.
Yeah.
It was just a moles digging with no goal. No, there was never a finish line or a... We had great management.
Yep.
Who, after a couple records, we stopped listening to.
Yeah.
I mean, look at what happened with the first two albums. That's all Pete Angelus.
Yeah.
That's all of us. That's all of us doing
a team.
That's exactly right. It's entirely a team effort. And then when the band, and by the band, I mean mostly when Chris started saying, "I don't want to do all that promotion shit. I don't want to do this." He wasn't also interested in allowing us to then. It was a constantly like, okay, well, what do we? Okay, if you're not going to do that, what will you do? And if you're not going to do that, well, then can someone else do it? How do we work around it?
Right.
So much energy. And it's like this with every band. But so the hardest part about being a band is just being in a band.
No, it
the
is.
The hardest part of it is it.
That's it. The and easiest part is the gig,
the
2 hours.
The energy spent on trying to keep it going eventually overtakes and swallows. That's the same story with every band. And
right.
When you add huge drugs to it. And, you know, there was all these dynamics within the band. When the band first came out, it was five guys. That was a five-piece band.
Right.
And then we let Jeff go, or he quit. We bring two new guys in, and those two new guys are immediately like Chris's guys.
Yeah.
And so now it's 3-on-3, but it's not – but me, Rich, and Johnny aren't a team. We're not
– Yeah.
We're not, like, pairing
You're
up
not
against
bros.
Those three.
Right, right.
We're – you know, you so you go from a five-piece band – five guys who are equals to four guys who are equals, but one of those guys has two buddies with him everywhere he goes.
Yeah.
They're just like, whatever you want, Chris. You know, and
yep.
I'm not banging on Mark and Ed for that. They walked into a situation.
I get it.
Those are the three guys that were wasted together. They were the drug buddies, you know, and Chris has to be surrounded with people that think he's right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how that shit goes. And, you know, and they both got eaten alive by it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Which is horrible and sad, but it's just what it is. I mean, none of it's new ground. It's all like every band has similar stories.
I mean, absolutely.
And then we had all these little, I mean, again, we had a band where it was five guys all doing this thing, and then it just changed into like, you know, three guys over here and three guys over here, and me, Rich, and Johnny all still lived in Atlanta, so it immediately set up 3-on-3.
Yeah,
and we were hardly copacetic. I mean, that was not the way we. I was furious about that. I mean, I fucking hated that mindset. Like, fuck you.
Yeah,
I'm not. I don't have. We're not pairing off.
Yeah,
a fucking band. You know, and then intertwined in all that, you still have the two brothers who started it. And who think it's all about them anyway.
Yeah, right.
You know, all the greatness that we're accomplishing, it's because they're writing these amazing songs, and neither one of them at the time gave any shit about what, you know, they didn't see it as, well, but the whole band is, it's so hard to define, but they were able to be great because they were surrounded by greatness.
Right.
We were great because we had greatness writing songs. I mean,
it's a great thing.
That you can't.
It's called chemistry.
That's it. And when you fuck one, and when one element goes,
that's exactly what happens.
It doesn't matter which guy. If anytime that from the three albums, the four albums that band made,
right.
Which is Southern Harmony and Morica Band. Well, I guess five if you count
three
Paul.
Snakes.
But the three that came out, and then Tall and Band.
Right.
You know, that's from December 91 to the spring of 97. All the recording that band did was so – it was just chemistry. That's all it was. It was perfect. And when it fell apart in the summer of 97, we put it back together and did new things. And we've had bands that have toured – we've had lineups that – I've enjoyed even more at the time. You know, I thought it was even somehow more cohesive and more focused because everybody was a little more clear-headed.
Right.
But obviously that was the time when it was the perfect mix of attitude still, but with information and knowledge and fearlessness and all those things that you can't, once they're gone, they don't come back.
After Amorica is when you do the band record?
After Three Snakes.
After Three Snakes. Oh, so like
so
before,
Three
but by your
was,
side.
Three Snakes was out there.
Right.
That was out there. Band dialed it back in.
Right.
Brought the songwriting beyond. But like Another Roadside Tragedy and Find Peace Anyway and Wyoming and Me and Smile, all those songs.
By Your Side.
And which was called If It Ever Stops Raining originally.
Right.
Same exact song, but a different chorus lyric.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
If It Ever Stops Raining. That was the best. Only a Fool. That was the that's my favorite album. I mean, when it was before it was mixed and touched up, it was just perfect. It was live in a studio, and I thought that was the best mix of. That's when we were becoming the band we had spent 6 years trying to be. That band,
right?
You know, like let's get away from so much of the like No Speak No Slave's awesome, right?
Yeah,
Exit, but we didn't want to. We were tired of being heavy. Like, just with volume and by hitting hard. It was like, let's fucking really show a lot more musicality and sensibility. And you know, we can take it down really low and we can, there's way more, like, the band. Like, listening
to,
you know, we love the band. But in 92, 93, 94, we couldn't have even thought about trying to sound like that.
Yeah,
let's
right.
bring it down so small. That there's that majesty. It's like it's a velvet hammer. You know, like the band is the heaviest shit in the world.
Absolutely.
But you got to really know your shit to get there. And it wasn't until we made that record when we called it Band. It wasn't a tip of the hat to the band. It was, but looking back, it's real clear. That to me is the first time we were one of those kind of bands though.
Like right.
set up in a room, get sounds, and we just, there was no ego. It was just there. We weren't trying to prove anything. It was the most confident and laid back and groovy thing the band ever did.
What it, the three
and then we end up assigned to Columbia Records.
Yeah,
and they hate it. They never even listened to the whole thing. They got three. They're like, no, you have to make a whole new record, start to finish, with one of our producers.
That's fucking weird.
They had no time for it.
The Three Snakes record is, I fucking love this record. But man,
I loved it more before all the. It's too thick. I mean, to me, that's the. I dig the record. When I hear it, I remember what it was. We made that record in Atlanta.
Yeah,
and then we came to LA to finish Final Overdubs, and just got a little too bloated with overdubs. When it was a little less on it, I thought it made more sense. I mean, I thought it was more. I think it's totally cool. When it came out, I was all into it.
Oh, man, I love it. It feels so dark and weird, though.
Oh, well, with good reason.
You can feel drugs coming off it and weird shit,
that's
man.
All it is.
That thing feels like a dark cloud.
I thought it just felt there was even more of a... That's like Presence, you know? And you listen to Presence, you're just like...
my favorite.
Me too. It's like, oh, God, they're doing a lot of drugs.
Yeah, you know, man. When you put it on, you hear Good Friday, you know, you're just like, whoa, this is fucking... That record really sounds like no band, is why I like it.
Yeah.
When I put on your other ones, I go, oh, this is Faces, this is Allman Brothers, this is... But when I put that record on, I go, this ain't nobody but them and their demons.
Well, that was it.
That's
sure.
It's cool as fuck, though.
You know, and again, like, I say stuff about our records... Knowing, I mean, it's funny because I'll talk to fans and I'll say something and they're like, how can you say that? It's great. It's like, well, dude, trust me. I heard it long before. But like I said a minute ago, I know what I, like Lions, like I can't listen to Lions.
I can't either.
But I did hear it last year on the bus. We put it on one day for fucking who knows why. Someone wanted to hear it.
Yeah.
And I was blown away because I was like, that could have been... so fucking great. It's one of those things that we went, it's the different, you know, what's a great analogy? I mean, it's 99 yards and 100 yard dash, you know, it's like, I was leading the race, but then I didn't finish.
Yeah.
So it's meaningless. It's like you were almost, that was a really weird time in the band and we didn't, it was just, the song, it should have been. That's the one that got away more than anything else. I hear Lions and I go, that was almost a fucking amazing piece of work, but instead, I think it's just a piece of crap.
Well, you know, I liked the record when it came out. My buddy hated it. I think it was, I was never into the Oddly Free era, and I love Oddly Free. I love Driving and Crying. They had, remember, they sounded like Bad Company.
Well, he was in, no, he was or in what Cry, was that? Cry of Love.
Cry of Love, that's what I meant. They sounded like Bad Company.
Well, you know, Oddly's not even on that album.
Is that right?
He's on a couple tracks.
I saw Oddly in the band. That
he did the tour.
Yeah, exactly. And I like that band, man. I thought they sound like Bad Company. It's cool.
Oh, Cry of Love was great.
Yeah, but he was more of a burner when he came in, and of course I was a huge Mark Ford fan, and by then it's unfair anyway. You're talking about a record. Most bands don't make past three records, you know.
Well, and we were the By Your Side thing was totally. I mean, I love Kevin Shirley, and we had a blast making it.
Yeah,
but we turned in band. We wanted to put out band, but then Mark and Ed weren't there, too. So when we went to go make By Your Side, it was the sort of first time in our career we'd ever had a record label forcing us to do something. And we weren't together enough to just say no.
Yeah.
And they said, well, we'll never release you. You're fucked. And we should have just said, okay, fuck you, and just gone and toured. And just, you know, we were – it was funny because, I mean, if it had been 4 years later, we would have understood – the internet changes everything. You know what I mean? We just didn't see anything then. We were still operating from a early 90s mindset in 1998. And well, plus the band had fallen. When Mark and not Mark and Ed, Mark and Johnny had left. And so without Mark and Johnny, it was like we were sort of rebooting. And it was just, well, we got to do this.
Was there a conscience like how did the hippie come in? Because it's to me, looking on the outside, of course, I saw the Horde, Mother Hips are like my favorite band, and there's this thing starting to happen, Allman Brothers, you got Government Mule and all that. And if looking on the outside, you go, that was genius move to pop into this Horde hippie thing, because rock.
Chris went to see the Dead in 91.
Okay.
We were home, and they played the Omni, and he went. And that was it. I mean, he walked into that place having no idea what it was going to be, and he left, and he was a different person.
Wow.
I mean, it was that simple.
And so he comes back, and he's like, we got a jam?
So when – well, we were already moved. We had already written Thorn in My Pride, and we were already working on things. We were already totally stretching out, but we were stretching out – you know, Zeppelin stretched
Zeppelin
out.
Way.
I mean,
exactly.
We were a rock band corner. That was jamming. We were not thinking in terms of dead jams. And you know, Chris took that. And I think there was a time when – We all knew for a while exactly who we were.
Yeah.
And that's that era that you know, makes so much sense even in hindsight. So just adding in those features and worried about playing. And, you know, we're looking around at bands like other bands at the time that were huge. You know, I'd go see them play, and they couldn't play. They were just making noise.
Yeah.
And it was exciting, and it was interesting, and it was punk, and it's great, but it just so fucking what, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, like Nirvana, at least, I mean, I love the songs. Like I get that. Like, I heard fucking Nevermind the first time. I went, wow, fucking right on.
Yep.
And a lot of other bands that around that time I'd see, and I'd go, I don't get it. Like, there's nothing about that. And that's just because we were in such a different place where if the song didn't immediately cut through, I would just hear how these guys can't even fucking play their instruments.
Yeah.
And not like I'm a Berkeley grad, but it was like, come on, get a groove. There's no feel.
Yeah.
There's no anything to it. It's just antiseptic sounding rock music, which I just never dug. I mean, fuck, man, REM had more feel. You know what I mean?
Hell,
they're hardly anyone's version of great, like, super uber players, but... You know, they had a vibe and a thing, and the Replacements even, which, you know, whatever. There was just all that sort of intangible, this is a thing. And there were so many bands, all the bands in the mid-90s that were coming out in the rock world, that was gone. That was not an element that anybody was pursuing. And so the jam world is where all that went.
Totally.
And
Traveler,
and so
Horde.
We're sitting there straddling both worlds going, where's our place? It's neither, so we just have to be us, and us turned out to be both. We walked right through that line. But that's, to me, like I said, that's what Little Feat and Led Zeppelin did.
Exactly. You're right. That's why I love Zeppelin. That's why once the Black Crowes turned into this band, that's when I think a lot of the part-timer fans boogie and the real fans come.
Yeah.
When I hear the jams, I know exactly. I go, oh, this is going to be my morning song. Mm-hmm. This is going to go into fucking, you know, Wiser Time or whatever. And I was really, really into that scene for a while. Not in the hippie thing, but like you said, more of the musical thing of like, you know, You had Mother Hips, who were just fucking killing it with these crazy jams. And then, you know, Black Crowes and even Blues Traveler. You know, I wasn't a big fan of them, but when you'd see, man, they were fucking great, you know, yeah, their right. shows, man. Yeah. And the vibe of the fans were into music.
Well, the thing that you find is, well, what was real apparent, especially on a horde tour, like, you could, we figured out how to expand and extend and be inventive and improvisational.
Yeah.
Bands that start from that world, they're never going to rock.
Yeah.
It's not in their DNA. You can't go the other direction.
Yeah.
You can dial it back. But, you know, like, I look at us on, and it was funny because, like, by 95, 96, in my mind, I was like, we weren't that good in 92 or 93. But then I'd hear a live show. I go, wow, we were fucking great.
Hell yeah.
What am I talking about? Yeah. We were killing it. We just weren't doing this, you know?
Right.
And it was
like the 96 stuff.
You know, that, and the 96, 97 stuff, to me, got a little too, some of it's too self-indulgent. I mean, I listen back to some of those shows if I were to, but I did at the time, and I'd go, okay, 2 hours and 15 minutes and 9 songs.
Yeah.
That's a bit much.
Well, 38 minute My Morning Song, yeah. Whatever. Great shit, though. For the, it's an era of the band. That's no, why Zeppelin's
hugely
great.
Important. Yeah.
You know, no, like no, great, no, Zeppelin 80, everything's.
Well, and again, but all that got us to the album that we called Band, which I think if that record had. There's a lot of ifs in our career. I mean, if David Geffen had never sold his label and, yeah. And Southern Harmony had been worked by the same people that worked Shake Your Moneymaker, it would have even been bigger. You know, we were primed, and then Geffen sells, and we end up being distributed by Reprise Records, and they didn't. They had no interest in the Black Crowes whatsoever.
That's weird.
Like, I remember in 93 doing festivals in Europe, and we were headlining in European festivals, Glastonbury and Pink Pop and shit. And Lenny Kravitz was over there, and just something, talking to Craig one day about, they were on Virgin, and it was the same people every country they went to. They were all Virgin. Everywhere we went, it was like a different company.
Wow.
There was no cohesion for worldwide promotion.
It's just all indie shit, right?
And it was like whoever Reprise could get on the phone and say, will you distribute this record? You know, it was a cock. It was fucking bullshit. And we're like, man, that would be nice, wouldn't it? To be on a label that was kind of, that all had the same plan, like everywhere you went. So, you know, you'd go from Belgium to the Netherlands to France to Germany and have entirely different ideas of what your singles were, hits or
wow.
You know, like there was no cohesion.
They're all working different singles.
They didn't have any connection country to country. Whereas if you'd been a Sony band or a Virgin band, you might have had to put up a little bit more stuff with the high corporate shit. But at least there was a plan that was executed everywhere, and it was real apparent to us. You know, and there was nothing we were going to do about it.
Yeah.
We didn't lose sleep over it, but it was like, well, fuck, that'd be nice.
What was the Lions tour you did, the Brotherly Love tour? What was that like with Oasis? You got any funny Oasis memories?
Everything. They're awesome. We had a blast.
I fucking love that band. I saw Santa Barbara Bowl.
They're so fucking funny and fun, and just, we got on with them like a fucking house on fire. I mean,
wow.
No ego, no bullshit between bands on any level. It was all just, it's still that way. If I see anybody of those guys, and we're all like that. If we see them, in 2010, we were in Minneapolis on the same night, and we went and saw the first part of their show, and then they came and saw the end of ours, and we were all out all night together.
Wow.
Just nothing but love between those two bands.
That was a great tour.
It was fun.
Now, here's the biggest question I've always wanted to ask you. So I fly to New York, the band's getting back together, and they don't say who's in the band.
Mm-hmm.
And then I go to the Beacon, I think it was the Beacon or whatever, they did the 7 nights.
Oh, in 05.
Yeah. And the curtain opens, and this drummer is, it's like he can't play.
Yeah.
I don't understand what happened or how it went down, but he would slow down. He actually didn't know how to play at all, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
And it was probably some of the worst shows I've ever seen. It was insane because Mark Ford's back in.
Yeah.
The stage is badass. The crowds are crazy. And this, you could see Chris just screaming at the guy.
Yeah.
What happened there? And then you're in like 5 days later.
Well, what happened was I just didn't want to do it.
Right.
I mean, at first. And I just didn't, you know, I at the end of the Lions tour, I quit. We said, let's take a break. And I said, well, I'm taking a real break.
Yeah.
You know, fuck both of you.
You were just done with those guys.
Yeah. And just because it had gotten so, there was just no like infrastructure, if you know what I mean. It was just a thing that was happening, and there was no plan. There was no, I didn't sense any cohesive agreement on anything. It just seemed irreparably broken to me. Like, right. There's just no, you know, and Chris wanted to go do his own thing. So I'm like, fucking go. Quit trying to shove it down the Black Crow's throat.
Yeah.
We're not going to be a dead-like band.
Right.
I mean, that's awesome, but you can bring elements of things. We always did that. But he was just forcing this thing, and it was in the wrong band. You know, I said, dude, stop trying to fucking play football with a soccer team.
Yeah, right?
Go fucking...
Just go do it.
If you're coaching, coach the team you have. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
You always hate when I'd say that shit.
No, but that's true though, right?
Well, I just thought he, you know, he was always saying like, well, I'm trying to take it someplace. And I'd be like, yeah, but not a place that we're going to be. Why not work to what we're great at?
Yeah.
We do a thing. It's called Be the Black Crows. Let's just be that. But these are hardly linear conversations. We're all drunk and yelling at each other every day. It's stupid. And so... And the two of them, I mean, there's this just everybody that's ever around the band for any length of time, you're constantly in and out of, in between the two of them, in the middle of it, you know, because they don't get along.
That's got to be just so weird.
It's such wasted energy.
Yeah.
And it's a sad thing. But, you know, I mean, like, there's a school of thought that the Black Crow's always underachieved. And in my perspective, the Black Crow's fucking profoundly overachieved, because when you're handicapped with two guys who started the thing as high schoolers who can't fucking be in a room together, the fact that we got anything done is a miracle.
Yeah, right, because some bands do one record with that dynamic.
Exactly.
And I mean, never...
And it's a testament to everybody around them. And I'm not bagging them. I love those guys. And they're fucking great at what they do. And as you know, all the blanket statements to me are givens about how much it means to me. But looking at it, it's like, but everyone's energy eventually gets, you just get killed by it, because, you know, you want to be creative and you want to be productive and you want to go to the next place. And instead of deciding where to go, you're making it up as you go based on who's in a worse mood that day.
That's so crazy.
It's no way to run anything.
Yeah.
And so ultimately, I mean, that's the, no matter if the Black Crows work together again or they don't, no matter what, I mean, I think ultimately there's just, you got the records and you got all the live shows. That's the, of course, the most important thing. But beyond that, it's just, you know, everybody's narrative is going to be their own on it. But to me, it's just, you know, I always said that if we ever did a box set, it should be called Woulda, Shoulda, Coulda. You know, it's like,
so you say you don't want to do it. And then what, they're on the phone right away after the first gig?
No, we talked before the first gig.
Yeah.
They talked about it. And I just wasn't hearing anything that said it would be any different. I just didn't get the sense. Now, I mean, I didn't go back. I didn't go sit in a room with them.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Pete called and said, hey, Chris and Rich called. They're talking, you know, they want to do something. And I said, well, Godspeed, you know, go get it. And he was like, come on. I was like, nah. And I talked to Pete about it a lot, and then I had a couple conversations. I didn't ever, but I wouldn't go to New York and just sit down and hash it out. I was just like, no, I'm not. And looking back, some of that was me just enjoying the fact that I was going, no, fuck you. You
know? Yeah.
And again, you know, knowing full well, I'm, you know, there's a lot of bands I'm not the guy for, but to try to replace me in the Black Crows was like absurd.
Right.
I mean, it's just what it is.
Right.
It's like, you can't take a self-taught drummer who learned in this band what he's doing out and think anybody else can come in and do that.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
It's like Simon Wright in AC/DC. It's like, what are you doing?
Exactly.
You
know? It's true.
It's true.
It's just the sound's not there. So I was acting a little bit out of just, no, fuck you guys. You know, I was just. And I had been really busy and doing other shit, and I was very happy to not be doing it because I didn't want to walk right back into a fucking another family nightmare,
right,
which is what it was. And they went out and started playing shows, and I just moved to Nashville the year before, so I was doing sessions all the fucking time and just getting shit. I was just very happily doing other stuff, and I started hearing from people around the band, just a couple of conversations, because everybody's always talking still.
Yeah,
it's not like I never heard what was going on. And I could just, there's a few things that are very personal and no one's business, but I was like, oh, well, hang on, that's very different to hear. And, you know, when Chris finally called me once and we got on the phone together, and I said, well, I don't even remember the the specifics, but it was just very much. I hung up the phone. I looked at my wife and I went, I can't believe what I just heard. I mean, I've been waiting 20 years to have a conversation like that.
Yeah.
Or whatever it was. And I said, I think I got to try it. Because, and another thing happened right before that tour, which was Bruce Springsteen inducted U2 into the Hall of Fame. And I watched that. And the speech he gave, and then Bono's speech about what a band means, all that. I got really,
yeah,
it bummed me out because I was like, man, we had that and we just fucked it up. I mean, like, lost sight of the fact that it's a band. It's a group, you know, you're all trying to do this. And, you know, and I'm thinking, man, I let those two fuckers ruin this thing. Yeah. I should have done more.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I knew what I was dealing with.
Yep.
And I let them wear me down. And I didn't like how I had left and how it had ended. And so I thought the tour was, and Pete kept stressing, this is not about a record. It's not about anything. We're just playing shows, just playing shows. And when I talked to Chris, he was like, just come and play. Just see, why don't you just come see how it is? And I was like, oh, yeah, I mean, that's not going to hurt.
Yeah.
So I went back in 05, mostly thinking, I mean, bar none, most important thing was just rewrite the ending.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Make it, you know, and having Mark back definitely was like, oh, well, fuck.
That's insane, right?
Because that's, now we can, maybe we can pick up. And I knew Johnny would never come back in a million years, but I love playing with Sven, so I was totally cool with that. And I thought we can go right back to 97 where the, again, everything to me is that album Band.
Yeah.
And I thought, if everybody's learned their lesson and we can keep our shit together, we can go right back there. And now we're even, our audience is more, they all will accept it now. Like, it won't be a left turn to anybody. They've had a decade of listening to all those bootlegs.
Totally.
And so that's how 05 went. And 06 went that way for a while.
But my question on 05 is, like, they only play a week and then you're in. Like,
I think it was like 20 gigs.
20 gigs. Well, I was in New York for the first six or whatever.
Right.
Like, how did the rehearsals go down? They see this guy can't play.
Well, dude, you're asking the wrong guy.
I know.
I have no idea.
I mean, that's why I wanted to know what the conversation was about. Like, did he call and go, oh, my God, we made a crazy mistake?
No, but he didn't have to.
I mean,
they had talked to Jeff Sipe, who's an amazing drummer. Jeff Sipe is a fucking six-limbed monster on the drum kit, right?
Yeah.
They had talked to him about coming in to take this guy's place, well, the Bill's place.
Right.
And by the way, Bill Dobro is a fine drummer. The
guy's,
he's great, just not in the Black Crowes.
Yeah.
He's a completely valid and multi-talented guy. I mean, he's an excellent drummer. That's just not his band.
It just seemed to me like he just got, he froze.
Deer in the headlights.
Yeah, he was like, oh my God.
Well, music's one thing in a room. When you get on a stage, you know, and the truth is, music's 99% confidence.
Yeah.
And if you've never been in a band with a front man like Chris Robinson on stage, who's the energy that guy's putting out when he's really dialed in, and he was in 05, and when Rich is dialed in and digging in, that's a lot if you've just been playing with singer-songwriters.
Yeah, you're right.
That's like, whoa, what the fuck?
Shit is rock.
No, you're jumping into, you're getting on a roller coaster and you've been on the Ferris wheel all day.
Yeah.
It's a very different thing. So, and Jeff Sipe was a guy they had talked to. And Jeff's, I mean, literally the guy can play anything. And I had a conversation with him. He's like, oh, I can't even figure this shit out. And I'm like, you're just overthinking it, dude.
Yeah.
He's like, no, it's not that. It's just so intrinsic with the, it's just, no one else can do this shit. And that's as much a testament to me not knowing what I'm doing as it is to me knowing what I'm doing. But it's all feel. I mean, drums, it's all feel. The rest is just bullshit.
Well, you always had an amazing feel.
So that was the thing. I mean, that's what it came down to. So I went back and I started in Atlanta.
Yeah.
Which I just love that story, too. I was like, well, if I'm going to go back, I might as well do it now. It's in Atlanta. You know,
it's so great, too. They don't tell anyone.
Yeah. No, we just came out and hit the first downbeat.
God damn. I remember I was online because like, and then there, I'm looking, I wanted to see the set list, and it's like, oh, Steve's back. It's like, fuck. I saw the shit shows. But then, of course, I saw all kinds of that tour, you know, here at the Fonda and the Fillmore and all that. But man, that thing of like Mark Ford and you know, it's just insane.
Well, it sucked because in 06, it just we got through 05 in one piece, and then all the same shit reared its head again.
Yeah.
And everybody, it just derailed in 06. And it was the fall of 06, we were touring without Mark and without Ed, and it was just, that blew. I mean, we had two really good musicians up there, and we got really experimental because it was like, well, fuck it.
Let's just, with Luther?
Before Luther. Paul Stacey did a tour.
Oh, I forgot about that, man.
Paul's fucking amazing. He's a
Paul's
wizard.
Amazing. He did those Chris Robbins. He was Chris Robinson records.
But, you know, it was... That was just throwing against the wall and seeing what would stick. Because there was... I mean, talk about not having a direction. And then... So, you know, I really enjoyed 05, and I was really enjoying 06 until... And it just went like that. And again, I mean, the conversation about addiction is a whole different thing.
Right.
But I certainly have educated myself since then to a level I never would have cared to. I mean, I just... You have to.
Yeah.
Because it's going to eat you alive, too.
It's true.
You know, you got to learn what you're fucking dealing with. And so... You know, and then, like I said, but I loved what we did with Luther. We put that back. You know, when Luther and Adam came on, fucking Adam McDougall there's no way to describe what kind of musician that kid is.
Right.
And Luther's fucking touched. And so we put a whole nother, that was like an entirely different band.
I mean, it was great.
And it was a great band. We had shows in 8, 9, and 10 that I thought were I'd put up next to anything in any era. A different thing. I mean, it's like...
Totally different.
And I mean, again, sports analogies just are easy to throw out there, but it's like, you know, yeah, I love the Bulls with Horace Grant, but they're pretty fucking good with Bill Cartwright, too. I mean, as long as you got Jordan in there, as long as you got Pippen, as long as you got Phil Jackson, the rest of the pieces, it'll still be really good. It's just a different flavor.
I think
it's not the same. I mean, that's not to be taken literally, but. You know, we made a really good version of the Black Crowes again, and we made some really good. We made War Paint and Before the Frost, a couple of really cool records with that band.
Yeah.
So I mean, and so at the end of 2010, 20 years, and I was good. Put a bow on it. Call it a day. That's
right.
You know, fine.
Right.
We made it. No one's dead. No one's dead. Fucking, we win.
Yeah, that is true. Right? It's crazy. So now you're doing Trigger Hippie.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about that. You've been
Trigger Hippie's been in my head for 8 years. Nick, the bass player, Govrick, who is the principal songwriter for Trigger Hippie, actually. I mean, there's a lot of co-writes with everybody, but his name's on everything, basically. Nick and I started playing together in 2004 at a bar called The Family Wash in Nashville. And the first time I played with him, the first night we jammed, I said, man, we sound like a band. We're not two dudes jamming. We're a rhythm section, for real. And he was like, I know. It's fucking crazy. We got to do this. That conversation, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, early 2009, I said, okay, seriously, we've got to do something. And he's like, yeah, I got tunes. I got this and that. And then I had heard a bunch of the songs he'd written by that point, and I loved them. And I was like, let's do – we had this vision, which is – We had an idea for this band. You know, Nick and I, what would you want the band to be?
Right.
What's the vibe? And we were very right in the same, you know, wheelhouse with each other.
And what are you guys tossing around?
Well, it was just, it's just got a groove. I just want to see people dancing and having fun, but it's rock. It's not, again, that thing of like, it's got to be able to rock, but it's got to swing. And it's not going to, I don't want to see headbanging and I don't want to see just twirling for 3 hours.
Right.
Somewhere in the middle of those two things, you know.
Yeah, like some good fucking.
It's always like everything Zeppelin to me.
Everything's Zeppelin, right?
You know,
isn't it hilarious?
And so, let's find a real singer, and then we were playing with Audley Freed, who's a Nashville guy.
Right.
So me, Nick, and Audley were knocking around this idea, and Audley was always like, I mean, me and Nick were like, let's start a band.
Yeah.
And Audley's like, let's have fun. That's his mindset. Let's play. We'll groove. We'll get this. And in 2010, I said, all right, the Crowes are gonna. We're done after this year, so now I can really do this, Nick. Let's figure it out. So we spent a few months, and we thought about every singer we'd ever met, and I'm like, I can't work with a singer. You know, they're all... I've had enough singers in my life. But it was funny, because I got in a car. I'm driving home from the pool. I dropped my kids off at the pool up the street. I'm driving home, and St. Teresa from Joan's first album comes on, Joan Osborne, on Lightning 100, the station in Nashville. And I heard it, and I'd known Joan since Horde in 95.
Right.
And I just like literally hit my head. I went, fuck, I have not thought of a chick singer once.
Right.
I'm just thinking about dudes.
Yeah.
And I go, oh my God, Joan. And I walked in and I said to my wife, I go, man, fucking, what about Joan?
Yeah.
And she laughed and she goes, well, yeah, that'd be great. But she's probably busy. I mean, who, you know, what do you
got? Yeah, right.
So fuck, got to call her. I mean, I called her the next day and we talked about it. And I said, I said, I got a great guitar player. I got a great bass player. He's got some great tunes. I got a cool name.
Yeah.
And she goes, what's the name? I said, Trigger Hippie. And she goes, that's half the battle. I said, that's half the battle. And, you know, we're good friends. I mean, so we had a nice chat. And then she said, well, I'll just come down. Let's just throw around ideas and see what it is. Because she goes, I've just been thinking, I'm so sick of just being the person.
Right.
I want to be in a band. I've never been in a band. I can put my own band together, but that's not being a band member.
Right, right.
And she goes, I would love to be the singer in a band. I said, well, here's one. Come on. And she came to Nashville a couple months later, and we sat in a room for 3 days and just all, like, just in my iPhone recording riffs and ideas. And when she left, we were over the moon. Like, this is great. It really clicked. And we had all these ideas we really liked. And that was still with Audley Freed playing. And a couple months later, we were all together. And this conversation of, we should find... Be great. We got to find a dude who can play some organ. We need another guitar player, and it'd be cool if he could play B3.
Yeah.
And then it was, I don't even remember who said it first. Like, man, Jackie Green would be great. And I remember laughing, going, that's too much for one band. Jackie's like the whole fucking.
Yeah.
We've already got like Joan fucking Osborne.
Yeah.
And we're all badasses. I mean, we can't have another. There's no room. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like,
no, I need like a
super group.
I'm thinking, I need a Nashville utility dude.
Yeah.
I don't need another big, you know. A guy who does his own thing. But, of course, the more we're thinking about it, we're sitting around talking about it. And it's like, oh, fuck it. Let's just see what he thinks. And called Jackie. And he flew, like, a week later, he's in Nashville. Because he's like, well, it sounds like fun. And so we still had this idea. I still had this idea that it's Joan's going to sing. And then Jackie's just going to, you know, great backup vocals.
Right, right.
He and Nick can do backups. And just sitting around in the room one day, and he and Joan are just, they're just, throw, you know, they're just, oh man, you know that song I love, and you know what I love, and they're just referencing their favorite songs,
right,
of all different country and soul and everything. And then they would just start singing together. And then there was a moment, and I mean, I was just talking to Nick about this the other day. I don't remember what song it was, but they just started singing this whole thing together. And me and Nick looked at each other like, okay,
yeah.
Very quickly changing my vision for what this band was going to be. You know,
right.
It was like, boom, that is incredible.
That's organic and
totally.
Chemistry, right?
When they started singing together, it was funny because we all, and they knew it too. It was like, that's unexpected. Because, you know, great singers don't necessarily sound great together.
Right.
It not at all. So, I mean, in a way that, like, I've played with some bass players that I love and there's no click whatsoever. Like,
there is,
but not like, Like when me and Nick, first time I played with a guy, I was like, that's my bass player right there. That's my dude.
You know?
You just can't.
It's like
make
I said, when
up.
You play with different drummers in my band,
of course.
There was every time the songs were different or whatever, and some drummers come in, you go, fuck, this is the guy.
You know, my shtick, which is very, I mean, I believe this wholeheartedly, which I've always said, for people that don't get drumming or what the deal is with it, if you listen to. Put on side two of Sergeant Pepper when they do the Sergeant Pepper reprise, where it just counts in one, two, three, four. That's the best. That's the grooviest drum straight beat that's ever been recorded. And you can put 100 drummers in a room, and none of them will feel like that.
Right?
They'll all feel cool themselves.
Yeah.
But it's so no one can play. No one plays like Ringo Starr.
Yeah.
Just like no one plays like Bonham, just like no one plays like any no drummer that does his own thing can ape other drummers, and that drummer cannot be aped.
That's why it
there's
didn't
a
work
million,
with the Black Cross.
A million session drummers can all go mimic each other. They're all mimicking guys. You know,
yeah.
Like a bunch of guys who are in Zeppelin cover bands can all play alike, but none of them sound like Bonzo.
No, not at all.
You know
you're
what
right.
Mean?
You're right. Yeah, they just don't. They're playing the parts.
It sound like they don't feel. It's just it's. Everyone's got an infinitesimal difference of within their own right foot and left hand and right. You know your kick, snare, and hat in a straight beat. Everyone's got a billionth of a second different flavoring.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah,
I mean I could play that same thing 1,000 times and it's not gonna feel like what Ringo does. And like when we played with Paige, which was just a blast. Of
oh
all
yeah,
time,
man.
I mean, I think Jimmy really digs my playing, but it's because I'm being me. I'm doing those parts, but I was not, I was never like, I've got to do this just like Bonham. It's like, no fucking way. Why would I throw myself off a building like that? It's like,
that
no, I'm going to do it my way.
That had to be wild, right?
It's far more, to me, it was the only way to be respectful was to be me. I mean, like, no, I'm inspired by Bonham. I rip John Bonham off every day of my life, but it doesn't feel like Bonham.
Yeah.
I don't sound like him. I'm not him. It's like, it's, there's just, it's such a connection from your hands and your heart to what you're playing that, and maybe just drummers hear it, and maybe, and shit, half the drummers probably don't, but I do. I've always known, like, to me, you know, like, I'm the baddest motherfucker of my generation.
Yeah.
But the fact that anybody else on earth might even agree is mind-blowing. Like, I think I am.
Yeah.
But if you do, shit, are you serious? Really?
What was Jimmy Page like?
Awesome. Love. Yeah.
I was supposed to open for you guys at the Shoreline, and then what was that?
With who?
With the Black Crowes, Jimmy Page. There was like a side stage Levi thing. They were going to do this. You guys were coming to the Shoreline.
Yeah.
And then they said Jimmy slipped and hurt.
I did five. He had a bad back. He fucked his back up.
Oh,
and
man.
It was a recurring thing. And it, or he had done it. We didn't know about it until it was out. But he was. We were in L.A. We were getting ready to go play Irvine Meadows. We did a Tonight Show and walked off stage. And then, well, let me back up. We played Albuquerque. We did the first leg of the tour. It was like 12 or 13 shows. Had a 3-week break because my wife was due. Like, we booked that so I'd be home for the baby to
right.
come. Which, and thank God he did show up during that break. It was good. We flew to Albuquerque and played one gig with Jimmy. And then we flew to L.A. for a day off. And on that day off, he couldn't even, like, walk. He was a mess. And
wow.
We were like, what's all this? And it was, like, a real problem. And he had a chiropractor and an acupuncturist. He had all these people at the, we were at the Sunset Marquee and getting him straightened out. And we went to do the Tonight Show and we did the Wanton song.
Yeah.
And he walked out of the building and like, he's like, I'm going fucking home. I mean, that was it. Done. We didn't,
wow.
Irvine Meadows was the next night. We didn't play it.
Yeah. A Shoreline a couple nights there.
Yeah.
I remember I had my Les Paul and I was like, fuck, he's going to sign it. It's going to hang in my house.
But playing with Jimmy was, he was awesome, dude. I mean, like a consummate gentleman. And that's a guy who in rehearse, but then you get on stage and there's this Superman cape that comes out that you haven't seen yet. And it's like, when that guy gets dialed in, and back then, Jimmy was still, he was still drinking and back then. And he wasn't like, he wasn't a mess, but he was not sober.
Yeah, he's drinking wine.
He's been 100%. He got sober like not that long after that. I mean, he's stone cold clean. He looks amazing now.
I know, right?
If you go back to 2000, he didn't look, he's not
all
healthy.
Bloated.
Yeah, he was not.
He wore the
shape.
Weird black sweatsuit.
He wasn't in good shape. And, but he'd get on that stage and man, that, you know, all of a sudden, there'd be like a couple solos and it would be like, yeah, that was great. And but then this gear that you don't know where it comes from would hit. And then it would just, it's like fucking hold on for dear life, man.
Wow.
And so for me, it was.
You had to be going crazy.
Oh, yeah. And we got on great. We was always super sweet. He's been nothing but compliment. He's always like really, really nice to me. But I mean, he's a fan of my playing. So that's, you know, and all I've ever said is, dude, all I'm trying to do is Bonham. But when I say I'm doing Bonham, I'm doing him as me. I'm not doing
right.
it like a
the
cover
spirit
band.
Of
and,
rock.
And that's actually the word he always uses. We got to find the spirit. You got to find the spirit. You got to find the spirit. And it was always that thing of just, you know, I'm going to go over here, and I made damn sure if he went somewhere, I followed him. You know, I was like, I'm with you, dude.
Yeah, keeping it going.
And we had a blast. And, you know, and like the first, you know, there were shows where we played things way too fast, but it didn't matter. I mean, we were all there together. It's not even about the. We did this. We did six shows in '99, which is what the album came from.
Right.
The album's from the last show at the Greek, just one night, and those were the energy was insane. But we thought that was it, six and out. And then the next summer, when we went back to do like a full world, 55 gigs booked, we brought everything way back. We were way more grooving the next time around, and that was. So that was more fun for me.
Right.
You know, like I was like, man, we're getting into some fucking jams
here. Yeah, laying back.
And so it was those shows were, we were on our way to it being even way thicker and heavier and better.
I was so bummed myself.
You and dude. I mean, I remember I flew home the next day and I was like, I'm going back to my 3-week-old son. So I'm like, I'm cool with that. And I'm really glad that that timing of that made it. I wasn't like if it had been a year earlier and we were not dealing with our first child and I just went home and that was canceled, I literally would have cried for 3 months. I was having the best time of my life.
So Trigger Hippie, we're talking about it. I love this song. I was saying,
Rise Up Singing.
Yeah, man. And what is this? You did a thing on, it's live on WFUV.
Oh, FUV from New York, yeah.
Okay.
There's a bunch of shit now. The record's out Tuesday, September 30th.
Right.
Yeah, Rise Up Singing's a Jackie song. He wrote that. You know, we had started working with him, and then he just sent me an MP3. He goes, I wrote this. I think it's like a, I hear it as a duet. He just sent a demo. And it was that exact arrangement that this was, you know, there's other songs that people have brought to the band and then we've totally changed, you know, you change it a little or a lot or whatever. And
right.
You can, you know, like every song, I think that song's a Jackie song. Nick has a couple. And then every other song is a combination of 2, 3, 4, 5 of us, you know, whoever
right.
was on it. But that one, like I heard that MP3 of just Jackie playing every instrument and doing it himself. And I was like, done.
Yeah.
Like, that's untouchable. It's perfect.
I feel like this is the best thing Jackie's been in. You know, of course, people love his solo stuff.
Yeah.
And he played with you guys. He played with the Dead guys and stuff. But when I saw this video and him and Jones singing, I was like, this is incredible, man. It feels like this is what he should be doing.
It's amazing because, like, for both he and Joan, this is the most fun they've had in so long because there really isn't. You know, when he's Jackie Greene and she's Joan Osborne, everything's on their shoulders.
Yeah.
Like, the band is totally their responsibility. Well, neither one of them's going to look at me and tell me how to play.
Yeah. Yeah.
And or Nick or Tom Bukovac. If you're coming Wednesday night.
I'm coming.
I promise you, when you see the band, what you will say to me, the first thing you're going to say is, that's the best guitarist I've ever seen.
Wow, really?
Tom Bukovac.
All right. Who do you play with?
Every country session in Nashville for the last 10 years.
Oh, you know who I love in Nashville?
He's a Cleveland rock dude
yeah.
who ended up in Nashville, and he has been the absolute – he is the first call of everything. He's done – he's got – he's a guy that guitar players know as that's the dude.
Whoa.
But he has no public persona. And I called him 2 years ago when we had some gigs came up, and Audley said, look, I'm going to bow out. You know, we had some songs written, and we were at the point where we were all really ready to kind of get serious, but we weren't, but it just hadn't ignited. We were having fun. We played some shows with Audley, and it was like, this is cool. But he was like, look, y'all are, the four of you are getting really, like, I can tell, like, you're going to run with this, like, for real.
Yeah.
Which was 100% my intention. And he goes, I'm not into that. I'm doing my sessions. I'm writing. I got this and this and this and this. And I don't have room in my head for this. And so just tell me, you know, I'm going to bow out.
Yeah.
And I'm totally cool. I mean, we're
Absolutely.
All great friends, but it was just this thing of, and so I had done a set. I had just met Bukovac. I'd heard about Tom Bukovac for 8 years in Nashville and the legend of this guy. And I was
wow.
like, who is this fucking guy?
Yeah.
I finally met him and he's like, this hysterical rock dude from Cleveland. I didn't expect that at all. I thought he was going to be an old Nashville coot. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so we hit it off right away, and I called him. I said, I got this band, and we got 3 gigs. And I know, and like Tom's been asked to join. Bob Seger's asked him for 5 years to be his touring. He's played every session with Seger for
right.
years. He does all the like Dave Stewart records. Like Dave Stewart flies him all over the world to be, you know, he's on. His discography is unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
But he doesn't tour. He doesn't go out and play.
Right.
And so I said, just come play 3 shows, maybe, because I thought, well, I got to at least ask him. And it was funny because the first time I ever heard about him, it was Audley. And Audley uh-huh. said, oh, you know, Bukovac. I said, now, who is that? And he looked at me and goes, you don't know Tom Bukovac? I said, I've never met him. Who is he? And Audley goes, well, he's a fucking genius. That's who he is. And I go, what do you mean? And he goes, he's the best guitar player I've ever met. And I'm like, to Audley, I'm like, the best guitarist you've ever met?
Yeah.
What does that even mean? Like, Audley, you fucking put together our gigs with Jimmy. Like, Audley was the MD, essentially, of that tour.
Wow.
And I'm like, he goes, no, I'm telling you, Bukovac's the most comprehensively all forms, all fat, everything you would ever want. He's like from a laboratory because at the beginning of all of it is his feel. He's just his passion. It's not technical, but he does everything. And he was just, the way Audley described this guy, I was like, in my head, I'm like this legendary figure. And then when I met him, he was like, again, just this dude from Cleveland who was hysterically funny.
Wow.
And I called him, this is in 12, and I said, we got 3 gigs in the Northeast. He goes, that sounds fun, man. What is it? And I said, it's called Trigger Hip. He goes, that's a cool name. Who is? What is it? And I said, and I'm thinking, okay, well, I got to sell him on the band.
Yeah.
I go, well, it's, you know, it's me. And I said, do you know Jackie Greene? He goes, yeah, that Oregon dude. Yeah, yeah, he's good, man. I said, yeah. And then Joan Osborne, he goes, oh, no shit. Yeah, right on. And I said, the bass player is a local guy. I said, you know Nick Govrick? And he goes, that curly-headed dude? And I said, yeah. And he goes, all right, I'm in.
Oh, man.
Like, the funniest thing was that, like, Nick was the final piece, which no one knows who Nick is.
Right.
He's a local dude who writes these beautiful songs, and he's a great player. But, you know, everyone knows a million great players that no one's ever heard of. And so Nick's one of those guys in Nashville. And, you know, but Nick went out and played with Mike Ferris for years. He's played a million gigs with a lot of people, but he's just never had his thing went anywhere. And so Book came out. We did three shows. And after the first night, Joan and Jackie both looked at me like, who is this guy? Where did he fucking come from?
Wow.
And we all said, if he doesn't stay in the band, we probably won't continue. Because
we
had a glimpse of what it could be. And if it wasn't going to be him, it would just never feel good.
Oh, that's
anymore.
The worst, right?
It was the worst. It was the worst. And after the third show, we played in D.C. And we loaded up the gear. And we're sitting there. And he comes over to me and Joan. He goes, all right, what are we going to do? And I said, what are we going to do with what? He goes, what are we going to do with this thing, man? I think I'm in.
Whoa.
And I mean, we had never, I wasn't even about to ask him. I was just afraid to hear no. And I could have cried. I was like, are you serious? Like, for real? Because this is, I said, man, I've got this. There's a plan. This is going to be a real thing. And he goes like, no, it's awesome. I love it. I've been waiting for something like this for a long time.
Wow.
And I mean, 2 months later, we were at his studio in his house starting to make the record.
That's incredible.
And then I had to go. The Crows went out for all of 13. So I was like, well, we got 3 months and then I'm off the hook for a year. But when I come back in 14, we're going to do this.
Yeah.
So it was like we had to put it. We got the band finally. We knew that was the band. This is the five people. It's right. It just took it to a whole nother level. And then we had to put it on ice for a year because the Crows had 120 shows last year.
You're lucky that nobody also, like, you know.
Well, got. Went off and did something else.
You're right.
Well, yes. Everybody, you know, believe me, everyone said, we'll be here when the Crows tour ends. And I was like, fuck, I hope so.
Man, right?
Because the way, you know, because everyone.
You know how that goes.
Well, four of the five members of this band have, you know, kids.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, Jackie's single, but Joan's got a daughter. Nick's got three kids. I got two. Book just had his first kid.
Yeah.
You know, so we're all in our 40s. Jackie's not. The rest of us are, you know, he's 30s. Yep. But the rest of us, it's just, again, like, scheduling. I mean, it's a lot to. Hold on, guys, but we all loved it. And when we during last year, we'd add, you know, we got basic tracks done. Then when we could all get in town, we'd do some more, and we put the record together over a year. And every time we got together, we were like, this is better than the last one. This is better than the last one. And we all, everyone works fast. Bukovac is a session maestro. I mean, he produced the records produced by Tom in the band.
Right.
We singled him out because he was always the final say. Not by any design. It just worked out that way.
Right,
it's just,
right.
You know, the organic nature of it was we would all get in there, and ultimately, Book just is the guy that's guiding it.
I loved it, man. I heard it
He's
right
amazing.
Away. I go, this is fucking great, man.
And it's as hung up as I am on the concept of a band, this really is one. I mean, it's five completely equal headspaces. Everyone knows exactly what they bring to this. There's zero ego.
That's cool.
Across the board.
Your Wednesday at the El Rey?
Yeah.
Is it sold out?
I do not believe it is.
Oh,
we've never played. We've played San Francisco. We've never played Southern California before.
Well, this will come out tomorrow, so everybody go see him at the El Rey.
It's a badass rock and roll band, I can tell you that.
How do you like Nashville, real quick?
I love it. I've been there. I grew up an hour north of there, and I've lived there 10 years. I'm never leaving.
You know who's a badass guitar player? What's his name? Kenny Vaughn
is a.
Oh my God! Let me tell you something.
He's tremendous.
The Car Wheels and a Gravel Road tour with Kenny Vaughn on guitar is top 10 tours I've seen.
I moved to Nashville in 2004, and the first session I got was with Kenny Vaughn. And I walked in the room and I was like, "Holy shit! I am a hack."
What is up with that guy? How great is he, man?
He told me my favorite joke. Kenny Vaughn told me, which is this. Why didn't Hitler drink tequila?
I don't know.
Because it made him mean.
That's a great joke.
That's a Kenny Vaughn joke.
Kenny Vaughn is a god, man.
He is a god.
I want him.
If you see Kenny Vaughn, ask him about Tom Bukovac.
I've been wanting him on the show. Kenny Vaughn was one of those guys where you see him at the Fillmore in Lucinda's band. They do You Took My Joy. And he does like a 20-minute jam, and it was one of the finest things of guitar I've ever seen.
The first session I did in Nashville that he was on, he was there as the acoustic guitar just strumming. He didn't even play a note. And I was like, what kind of town is this where Kenny Vaughn doesn't play a note?
He's the rhythm guy, right?
He was. Yeah, every session, you got a guy strumming an acoustic, and you got a guy playing a fucking Telecaster over there. He was the acoustic player, and I was like... And I don't even remember who the other guitarist was on that one, but he was great. I mean, he was obviously great. Nashville sessions are hilarious because a lot of times, you know, it's just 1-4, 1-4, 1-4,
right.
5-4, 1-4, you know. And you're like, but the players are so fucking good. They get so creative in the tightest box imaginable.
Yep.
And then it always gets mixed through that Nashville filter of mix, and
hilarious.
So it's gone. But in the room,
yeah,
it's... People say, like, man, some of the music, it's all the same. And I'm like, man, but when you're doing it, it's a blast.
Yeah, yeah.
Because all the guys are such great players. They're and you're talking about no ego. It's all just serving the song. They're on the clock. It's professional musicians, which I'm not one. So to me, to walk into that world, it's like it's awesome. I don't ever feel like, you know, I know how guys get burned out when that's all they do.
Yeah.
It destroys their soul after a decade or two.
I can see that.
But for someone like me who I can just go in and do them and then I do my own thing, I mean, it's amazing. It's incredible. I mean, I've learned so much from those guys.
There's been some great records come out of Nashville. Terrible. Most of it's terrible.
The big, what they call music row country records, all that big stuff.
It's all
the
jive.
Same.
It's all hysteria, Def Leppard hysteria.
It's all written by committee, and it's all the same writers, and it's all the same producer. It's just, and by the way, though, see, that's what Nashville has always been.
Absolutely.
It's just that in the 60s, all the same guys were making the records, but we just like those records better.
Yeah, well, I like Jamie Johnson now.
Yeah, he's awesome.
You know, I even like the Tim McGraw record with Drugs and Jesus and all that. Record's fucking great.
Bukovac played every guitar solo.
I'll tell you what, that record's phenomenal, man. Yeah. That, you know...
You've heard Tom... Anyone listening to this has heard Tom Bukovac more times than... it would blow your mind if you knew how much this guy's played on. And he's just, you know, by the fucking grace of God, he's in Trigger Hippie.
Well, thanks for doing the show, dude. You got to understand, I'm a huge fan. I mean, you're an amazing drummer, dude.
Thank you, bro.
I've watched you play half my life, so, and it's so cool to have you on my couch here.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
At the fucking house here.
Yeah.
You're Jay, I do Jay Moore Sports, and you have the show right after.
Steve Gorman Sports.
Steve
which
Gorman.
Which I had first.
Yeah.
That was my name before he was on the air.
Steve Gorman Sports.
Cocksucker Jay Moore. I met him. That was the funniest thing. He was in Nashville a couple years ago. And just doing the rounds because he was doing Zanies.
Yeah.
And they brought him in to do my show. And he had no idea what it, you know, he just was like going to the next studio.
Yeah.
And he walked in and he's a Black Crowes
fan. He's a huge Black Crowes fan.
And he saw me and he just went, what the fuck are you doing here?
Yeah.
And he freaked out.
Yeah.
It was really, because I was like, it's my show. And he was like, you don't have, you can't have a radio show. You're a drummer. And I was like, yeah, I hate to tell you, but I do. And,
it's so great because we're Black Crowes freaks.
And then like 3 months later, I did his podcast that week.
Yeah.
We did a road trip to Knoxville and back. And then like 3 months later, he calls me. He goes, I just got Jim Rome's radio show on Fox Sports Radio. And I was like, what? Like, shit, that's what I'm trying to do. And then so he started. And then a year later, you know, I went. So, yeah, I follow him.
That's so cool. You got and you're on Monday through Friday.
Monday through Friday, 3 to 6 Eastern.
And then Trigger Hippie going on tour.
We're doing a California, we're just doing a week of shows this week. Southern shows for a week at the end of October. We're in New York in November, mid-November, just one night in New York. And maybe some stuff in December, but 15 is going to be a busy year.
That's great, man.
Yeah.
And you got a Twitter.
At SGS Fox
is
the radio Twitter, and then Trigger Hippie Net is Trigger Hippie Twitter.
There you go. So follow them, and thank you so much, man.
That shit's all on Trigger Hippie. The record's out Tuesday, and it'll be on. You can stream it anywhere.
Yeah,
as soon as it's out.
It's fucking great. I can't wait to see it.
You're gonna dig the show, man.
What was the Joan Osborne hit? The big one.
What if God was one of us?
Oh, yeah, that's it. What if God was one of... Yeah, man. And Sven used to play with her, right?
No.
Pippian? Didn't he play bass?
No, Andy Hess, who played on the Lions tour with the Black Crowes,
played
with Joan.
I got you, okay.
Yeah.
I knew somebody from the band had played with her, yeah.
Yep.
Well, man, thanks for coming by.
Pleasure,
and
bro.
I can't
I'll see you Wednesday.
Yeah, I can't wait, man.
Yeah.
There it is. Thanks for tuning in, guys. See you later.